Midday edition, sir. Thank you, sir. New York, get your paper.
Hitler has not yet been withstood by a great nation with a willpower the equal of his own. Many of these countries have been poisoned by intrigue before they were struck down by violence. They have been rotted from within before they were smitten from without. How else can you explain what has happened to France, to the French army, to the French people, to the leaders of the French people? This is no war of chieftains or of princes, of dynasties or national ambitions. It is a war of peoples and of causes. There are vast numbers, not only in this island, but in every land, who will render faithful service in this war, but whose names will never be known, whose deeds will never be recorded. This is a war of the unknown warriors. But let all strive without failing in faith or in duty, and the dark curse of Hitler will be lifted from our age.
Well, it's Friday, it's 5 o'clock, and welcome to the online BCFM Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, helping me review this week's news. It's Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Couldn't do the show without you, Martin, really, because you add that little, take that step back and take a much bigger perspective. And that's what we are suffering from so much with the mainstream media. The mass media nowadays is they'll show you a tiny little snapshot of something that's going on with no perspective and no proper analysis. Anyway, in the second hour this week, after Putin's big World War II speech last week, this week he successfully changes the Russian constitution in a referendum to allow himself to stay in power for another decade. Why do those stupid Russian people keep voting for him? Have they been brainwashed? Or have we? And China brings its new national security law into Hong Kong, effectively ending the one country, two systems, which was supposed to last until 2047. Well, we're not even halfway there, and free expression as well as the right to peaceful protest has gone overnight. Not much left now. It's only that Chinese troops, many of whom see Hong Kongers as agents of the West, aren't yet on the streets. We speak to two local people, one student and one 30-year-old Hong Kong person who's living and working here in Bristol. And the Bank of England won't hand over 1 billion in gold, pounds that is, that Venezuela has sitting in their vaults. They think Guaido should be president, not Maduro, even though Guaido lost. Can anyone trust the old lady of Thread and Needle Street again with their loot? And as construction of the Nord Stream 2 passes Denmark and approaches North Germany, ready to supply Europe with cheap Russian gas, America slaps new sanctions on and Germany is not impressed. But will they actually do anything? Also, the pharmaceutical industry suffered a blow not being able to smuggle their mandatory vaccine schemes past under cover of the pandemic, giving us more time to find out if the information isn't smothered by propaganda or censored off the air, to find out what they're up to and how they care more about their profits than our health. Finally, the NuGenics. Yes, that's right, NuGenics and the Algorithm Ghetto, author of IBM and the Holocaust, Edwin Black, reflects on what he sees as the Nazi-style agenda behind the coronavirus hysteria. That's all in the second hour after 6 o'clock. So, joining me to review this week's news is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Martin, hi, welcome to the show.
Hello there.
Hello, Martin. So, what's been in your mind? Anything big in the national news or local news this week?
Well, I did an interview for Russia Today yesterday about the referendum.
Well, yeah, we'll be talking about that in the second hour. Anything in the local or national news?
Well, obviously, like everybody, we've got the end of the lockdown supposedly released tomorrow, pubs opening, etc.
I mean, it's going to be an avalanche, isn't it?
Well, I don't really have much confidence in the government's managing of the whole crisis. And I think that it's likely that mistakes are being made even as we speak. But there's plenty of discussion about that going on in the mainstream.
Will you be down the pub?
I don't really fancy it, to be honest. It's not going to be the same. You're not going to be able to interact with people properly. I mean, the whole joy of going to pubs is to be able to chat with people and make new friends and so on. It's just not going to be possible. And basically, potentially dangerous as well. I'm likely not to, actually.
Do you think people will be talking about the lockdown at pubs? That's what people used to do.
Well, presumably, yes. I think what they're likely going to be, they're going to be full quite easily, quickly, because they've got to keep people socially distanced. And they'll fill up, and then if you go to the shop, you can be pretty certain that the people in the shop will come out quite quickly once they've done their shopping. But if you're queuing up outside a pub, the people inside might decide that they're just going to sit there all night, and you're never going to
get in. If you go to the pub, Martin, you might only get half an hour in there, then you've got to go.
Well, indeed. All in all, I'm not really that keen to go.
I'm surprised, because I would have thought that's the sort of place that you can actually pick up sort of street level gossip that you will never get.
Normal pubs are my normally pubs would be my are my second home, but I just don't feel particularly at the moment that it's going to be the same sort of experience, or that you're going to be able to interact with people in the way that you normally could.
Obviously, the virus is the main topic, going to be the main talking point, as people are chit-chatting, making new friends, even if it is over a 2 metre distance. I suppose they might have to have a can with a string in between to be heard if there's a bit of a racket, because you're 2 metres away.
Well, you're not allowed to sing either, of course. No singing.
No singing?
No music, because that spreads virus.
It's a bit, isn't it? A bit puritanical, a bit like Cromwell.
Well, it's... What it is shambolic. We don't really... I mean, in New Zealand, of course, people can go to the pub like they used to do, because they crush the virus in short order, like the All Blacks rugby team. We, on the other hand, have completely messed up at every stage.
But Martin, I know you keep saying this, but we were far much further down the line. We had, you know, possibly even hundreds of thousands, some say millions of cases of the COVID-19 in Britain before anyone really realised what was going on. And, you know, Martin, let me finish. New Zealand and Britain actually locked down at the same time. It's just that they didn't have the cases we did.
No, and obviously they got more warning than we did. But nevertheless, I think there's probably going to be an inquiry about this, although the government are trying to wriggle out of it. Starmer was interviewed on LBC, I think, and he was saying, well, there'll have to be one at some point. And, of course, what will come out there is that Dominic Cummings decided to go for herd immunity, and they stopped testing and didn't lock down. That probably cost tens of thousands of lives compared to other comparable countries.
Okay, so Serco and Deloitte are two major companies, private, public companies, if you want to call them that. They have lots and lots of work in the public sector, but they're actually run privately. Both of them have major roles in the pandemic to do with testing and rolling out the testing program. And yet, for example, Deloitte, Martin, just literally last year were fined £6.5 million over misconduct of the audit of Serco, and then the Serco tagging scandal. They were fined another £4.2 million. That's over £10 million altogether, because they're just fraudulent. What they're doing is they were saying that people still had tags, and they were charging the Department for Justice for them when those people had actually been released and the tags have been taken off. So these are obviously an untrustworthy company. How come they've been put in the driving seat when it comes to testing?
Well, I mean, there's not even been a competitive tender for this. Well, it's because of the government's religious belief in the purity of the private sector. You know, they haven't actually got any background in test and trace. In places like Germany, it's basically the healthcare system has been geared up to do test and trace. So it has been run from the GP surgeries and so on. But to bring in, you know, you completely, you know, they're basically bog standard companies that do anything, and they said they can do this. But of course, they're not really, you know, they're having to basically recruit new staff from scratch.
Let me put it to you that one of the reasons that they've been being fined over the last, well, I mean, it's probably 10 years, Deloitte and Serco, over the last 10 years, regular fines, is because they are just breaking the law willy-nilly, knowing that the fine will nowhere near cover the what it would have cost them if they'd have obeyed the law. So they're actually awash with cash. And the central government is saying, well, who can afford to sort this out? And Deloitte steps up to the plate, Serco steps up to the plate and says, oh, well, we've got, you know, billions of pounds just slopping around here. We can do whatever you want.
Well, that's right. And as I say, there's been no competitive tendering on it. It's basically crony capitalism. I understand one of the heads of one of those companies was a Bullingdon Club member, etc. You can see how the country's being run. It's an old boys network.
Also, bringing things down to a bit more of a local level now, what about the council's catastrophic £82 million black hole due to the virus? This is Bristol City Council, apparently. I don't know if any of the reserves might cover this, but apparently it's urgent for the government to engage in conversations with local authorities, says Bristol Mayor Marvin Rees. He's saying, you know, he's flagging up here that the city may go bankrupt because of the virus and the government not supplying the city with the money to deal with it.
Well, that's a general problem across the country. The finances of local government have been completely destabilised. Now, you'd have thought that in that circumstance, the government would step in and say, don't worry, we'll back you up. They've done that with the private sector, of course. Lots of private companies have received lots of taxpayer money in order to keep them in business. But because of their war on local government, especially in big cities run by their political opponents, the Labour Party, the chances are that we're going to have an ongoing crisis in local authority funding. It's going to lead to situations where certain things are just not going to be paid for. They're just going to close, like toilets.
And one of the things that, of course, local authorities can do, one of the biggest resources they've got is land. Sell that land off as much as they can in order to fill that funding gap rather than go bankrupt.
Well, that's right. And, of course, what then happens is it becomes a fire sale by local authorities to try and scramble for solvency. And, of course, councillors are individually liable if they don't balance the books. And, the vulture capitalists are waiting to snap up all of this development land.
Interesting, isn't it, that the councillors get no say, really, in what happens. These are decisions made by the mayor, and yet they're the ones that are liable. Anyway, I thought we'd have a chat to the former mayor of Bristol, George Ferguson, about some of the things that have been going on in the city, and particularly the secrecy involved. This is something that's been a running sore, really, through the time of Marvin Rees, the Labour mayor's, I was going to say presidency, his mayoralship. Is everything's been getting more and more secret. The councillors themselves can't find out what's going on. And the latest we hear, an exclusive on this show from George Ferguson, is a large piece of land at Cannon's Wharf, or I think it's called, or Cannon's Marsh, which is just next to the watershed opposite the Arnold Feeney. Big open space there is being sold off by the council secretly. So let's have a listen now to that interview with George Ferguson I did a couple of days ago.
I'm George Ferguson, probably better known in Bristol as the old mayor, but my lifetime has been about architecture and urban design. I've been president of the Royal Institute of British Architects. We formed the Academy of Urbanism, which brings together professionals involved in good placemaking. So, you know, my life has been about making good places, really, and studying cities across the world.
So you had an opportunity to do that as mayor of Bristol. Did you manage to get certain parts of the city set aside for cultural use, for public use? Because, you know, as we know, and I'm sure you know, these developers and speculators are constantly looking for bits of land in cities that they can build, well, basic stuff like hotels that make lots of money, luxury housing that make lots of money, and that's surely something that you've got to be pushing against. You've got to try and make really the public, you've got to look after the public interest, otherwise the entire city will be turned over to housing and money making exercises.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's yes, what's really important, it's not necessarily a negative thing, what's really important is about getting a good balance. Good places are made out of a mix of uses. And when you get commercial development, whether it's commercial residential development or commercial office or retail development, is often a monoculture. I mean, it's, for instance, the huge company that's just gone bust that owns all those shopping centres. All they did was shopping centres. And, there's virtually zilch cultural content in what they did. And the big national house builders, all they do is house building. they talk about units. They don't talk about homes. And they don't bring life to the place, and they don't contribute enough to the cultural and educational provision that should be part of these places.
Okay, so were you able to, sort of take the map of Bristol and, you know, draw squares on it and say, well, actually, this part of the city I want to be preserved for some sort of public use or cultural use, or are you able to do that as a mayor?
To a certain extent, but I mean, it's a process that's been happening over years in this city. And I mean, ever since I came to the city in 65, so I'm still a newcomer in some people's minds. Ever since I came to the city as a student in 65, there have been plans, local plans, that have been looking at just this sort of thing. And I think those plans are moved to a large extent from being you'll put housing here and you'll put offices here to having a much more nuanced approach by planners to the way one develops things. And I got involved in the big row over the development of Harbourside, and because I felt that was, they were taking in the 80s, 90s, a very old-fashioned planning approach. I mean, when I say old-fashioned, I mean in a bad way. And it was just going to be a big office scheme and a big residential scheme, and a few of the, any retail in there would have just been standard national stuff, you know, like one sees in shopping centres. And very little of that, incidentally, anyway. So there, I think what I was keen on doing was taking advantage, for instance, around the Temple Meads area. As a city, your planning powers are relatively weak. Your ownership powers are very strong. So a city can use the land it owns in a very creative way. And it is a terrible waste if you use the land you own just to feed the developers. And so I actually acquired land around Temple Meads because I saw Temple Meads as moving the center of gravity of the city to a large extent. And famously, I was proposing the arena there, more than proposing it. We had builders ready to build it. And because I didn't want it just to become a commercial area. And we acquired the old sorting office, which is now to become part of the University of Bristol. And, you know, I think bringing in education and culture to help the mix in development is a really, really important thing to do. Otherwise, you get unreal, rather artificial places.
Now, you know, you do go back a few years, and I know once Bristol, I mean, because the thing is, the character of the city has changed, George, hasn't it? It used to be a very important port. The floating harbour used to be where all the ships came in down the Avon Gorge. Then that all moved out to Portbury, Avonmouth, and suddenly you're left with almost a purposeless dock. What do you do with it? I mean, as I understand it, there was even talk about filling it in and building office blocks on it.
Yeah, there was real talk about, it was mainly about car parking. You know, why do we have all this dirty water? Why don't we park cars there? And the whole of Callan's Marsh was virtually a car park in those days. Car parking seemed to be the principal driver. And I remember there was one of the multi-storey car parks in the city centre that's just off Queen Charlotte Street and near Bristol Bridge. And the then city planning officer gave a planning permission to a developer who wanted to build a 10-story office block and said, well, you can have your planning permission for a 10-story office block if you put 6 stories of car parking below it. What he meant is if you raise it by 6 stories and we build a multi-story car park underneath it. And that was the attitude to planning. It was nothing to do with how you make a decent place. It was all to do with numbers, which I'm afraid we're going back to. And I do criticize the current mayor about that. He's driven too much by numbers. And if you're just driven by numbers, you lose the quality of place. And that is really important in terms of sustainability, in terms of people enjoying the place that's created. Because if they don't enjoy it, if you build the sort of housing, the sort of places people don't want to live and work in 30, 40 years' time, they will be demolished again. And that's a terrible waste. And we've seen that happening from some of the stuff that went up in the 60s and 70s when I first arrived in Bristol. And I'm afraid we are going back to some of the development that is likely to have a relatively short life or be very tacky in quite a short time.
Now, and what about this site near the Arnolfini? Because I understand that that was originally earmarked as some sort of cultural site where we weren't quite sure what was going to happen with it. But now it looks as if it may not, it may be basically put into private ownership of some sort where there won't be any kind of public offering at all.
Well, it's a brilliantly valuable site that belongs totally to the city.
So where are we talking about, first of all?
It's directly opposite Arnolfini on the Lloyds Bank side, on the Bordeaux Quay side. It is quite a big open space that is adjacent to the big Lloyds Bank Crescent. A lot of people know it as a place where we have festivals and foodie events and things like that. There was a plan that I was quite involved in to build a centre for the performing arts there. It was when the big lottery money was coming out for the millennium. And it was at the time we did build Explore, which is now called We the Curious, and Wild Screen, which is now the Aquarium. And it was going to be one of the most fantastic music buildings in the country, and unfortunately it was approved, and then Newcastle came up with a scheme that went and stole the money effectively. So we were left with that site. Now that site's been there now for 25 years with an expectation of it becoming a cultural place, being a place for the people, being some sort of people's palace. Now, I can always see that you might put some other form of development on the upper stories, but to me, that site is one that belongs absolutely to the people of Bristol. And yet, secretly, the council have gone out to a competitive bid from invited developers, a competitive bid that includes design. And it only emerged very recently that one of those developers has been granted a development license by the council, or certainly it has been drawn up. Whether that has been granted, I doubt, because it hasn't been to cabinet. But this has all happened under the counter. And we've not seen the designs.
Sorry, George, to interrupt you, but surely a process like that has to be, some sort of open competition. It sounds to me as if you're inferring there that it's a kind of invite only, that various people have been approached, asked to come up with something for it. I mean, it surely has to be publicly advertised, doesn't it?
Well, it should be. I'm sure they've somehow got round it, but I mean, if I'd tried to do that, I would have been absolutely roasted. I was criticised for certain things, but they were all open, and they were open to scrutiny. This somehow has slipped through the net. We've never seen. I mean, I think we should have had a public display of the options available. The public should have been involved in thinking about what sort of public use there could be on the site. And it looks as if all we're going to end up with is an office block and yet another hotel.
Well, it might be that the reason that it hasn't, that Marvin Rees, the Labour mayor, hasn't been criticised over it is that people didn't know about it, George.
Well, I'm sure that's true. That's happening a lot. Scrutiny, which, is never fun for a mayor. although is vitally important in public life, scrutiny seems to have gone out the window. I don't understand. I suppose it's because, very differently to me, I was an independent mayor. I didn't have any councillors. He is a Labour mayor, and he's got the majority of councillors. So, in a way, they can get away with things that an independent never can, if, you know, never could if he'd wanted to, he or she had wanted to. But I'm amazed at what they are getting away with at the moment, and that these things just crop up.
I'm sure Marvin would say, if he were here with us, but he would say, wouldn't he, that the only way to get development done in this city is to just get on with it. The idea that every member of the public, that every councillor should have a veto on what you're doing. That's the problem that we've suffered from in the past, that it's just a very, very slow decision-making process and things just don't happen.
It's a matter of getting the balance right. This city suffered terribly in the days pre-consultation from, you know, some of the rubbish that went up in places like Lewin's Mead. And those were just bulldozed through, and some of the council estates and things, they were just bulldozed through. They weren't, there was no consultation at all. But I think public participation has improved planning. And yes, of course, you don't want to drag things out forever with loads of inquiries and what have you. But complaining about delay is to use it as an excuse for not having any form of public participation or consultation is not legitimate. I mean, that's there are some developers who are very good at consultation. I mean, I think that Martin Griffiths, who happens to be done the Bristol Stadium project for at Ashton Gate, Bristol City Stadium and Ashton Gate, I think he has been very keen to consult what goes on there, and I think has managed to create something that I very much helped with when I became mayor. I thought Bristol City Football Club was stuck with a terrible argument about whether they could build on Ashton Vale or not. I'd said, why don't you see whether you can be released of the obligation that you have to Sainsbury's to build a great big shed on there, because I knew Sainsbury's were losing the appetite for building new sheds. They went to see Sainsbury's. Sainsbury's were clearly relieved of the obligation, and the Bristol City Football Club got on with the development. Now, there is a cultural, a sporting use at the heart of a development that will grow into more things as well. And I think that that is a healthier way of developing a site that has a real cultural purpose than just simply trying to build a huge supermarket or an office park on it.
I mean, the mayor would argue, for example, with Western Harbour, that he wants a team that are all committed to build it, and that's what he's done. He's chosen people, rather than involving councillors and a lot of public consultation, to get a bunch of people who are behind the project to drive it forward.
Yes, I mean, I've seen the group of people that he's appointed. There are some good people there. And there is the chair of it is somebody who is, you know, virtually in John Savage, who pushed the whole idea of developing at Western Harbour. And I'm not against the principle of development at Western Harbour, but this bonkers idea of building a bridge. It was absolutely appallingly handled. The idea of building a bridge to replace the Cumberland Basin Bridge halfway between it and the Clifton Suspension Bridge is still held on by the mayor as a feasible project, would he? It's absolutely crazy. And he could have saved himself and the city so much time and money.
Well, why is it crazy? George, why? Why crazy?
Well, it's you talk about culture. I mean, the idea of building a highway bridge, anyway, it doesn't work. You know, the angles don't work. But the idea of building a big highway bridge in one of the most iconic views in the country, you know, of any city view, the view down the Avon under the Clifton Suspension Bridge, which would really, really wreck that view, is completely mad. I don't know how it came up as a serious option. And anyway, I mean, it was a terrible idea to build a portway, you know, to build a highway down one of the great natural, you know, one of the greatest natural beauty spots and places for wildlife and flora and fauna, the Avon Gorge. But then to exacerbate that by a new bridge bringing traffic across there is crazy. They didn't look at the fundamentals.
Well, surely, George, sorry to interrupt you again, but surely what they're doing is they're thinking, well, we want to do a lot of building here. Let's move the bridge westward to give more space to get that building sorted out. I mean, that's surely their thinking.
Well, that was the idea, but actually doesn't create more than a couple of hundred extra space for more than a couple of hundred.
I suppose
extra,
the problem is
dwellings there.
They're looking at it as almost like a kind of map section from above, rather than taking into account what the actual view for most people is going to be like.
Well, look, it was a report done by engineers, Arabs, who are very good engineers, but the idea, you know, and then a very false idea was given that by moving the bridge you could add thousands of new homes, which is just simply not true. And I think most people looking at it now realize the bridge is a non-starter. You know, a phone call to Historic England, what used to be English Heritage, would have told you this is a non-starter. This, you know, this will simply not be given permission. There was no fundamental thinking about how do we deal with the big issues. One of the biggest issues is the potential of flooding the centre of the city. That needs to be dealt with at Avonmouth. At Avonmouth, then you could get a crossing to the river that relieves the traffic off the M5 if the M5 bridge is closed. This is driven by Highways England, but Highways England are not thinking about the flooding. They're just thinking about the roads. And we need to bring all these things together to get a solution that works for everybody. And actually, one could dramatically reduce the amount of traffic going over the Cumberland Basin. And which is exactly what we need to do. We shouldn't have traffic charging down the Avon Gorge, thundering into the centre of the city from the southwest at such a crucial point. There are other ways of dealing with it. And then that's used as an excuse for building virtually a new town called Western Harbour. But Western Harbour is you know, is heading for disaster if it's again driven by numbers rather than creating a good place. Great, yeah, the city that the bits of this city that we love are driven by people who wanted to create good places. The streets in this city, which I, you know, I mean, the Bedminster streets. Okay, they're not great architecture, but they make lovely places. And I fear that the numbers that are being talked about will end up with hideous high buildings. I mean, already the applications in that area are for 9-story buildings, which are completely out of scale with what's around in that in the view of the suspension. Which belongs to us all.
Okay, let's get back to the team that's been put together to make this happen. I mean, as you say, it's a largely a John Savage project, which I believe he published way, gosh, was it back in 2010 or something?
Yeah, I remember I've got a copy. It's Bristol 2050, I think it was.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. But, I mean, this is basically Business West's idea. Obviously, this is what the developers and the speculators wanted to do. But there's this team been put together, which doesn't include any councillors or really local community groups. The idea, I suppose, from Mayor Rees, Marvin Rees's point of view, is he wants this to happen and he doesn't want too many people to be interfering.
You could take that line. I mean, there's some very good people on there, but they're largely people who don't want to disagree with Marvin. There's talk in setting up that about people with the necessary expertise. Well, there are lots of people there without the expertise. So I don't quite get that. There are only two or three people who I'd say have the right sort of expertise for considering new development of that sort. One is David Mallow, who's an architect, who is a colleague of John Savage's and very much part of the of Business West. The other is Martin Griffiths, who developed the new Ashengate Stadium, and he does know about development and he does know about mixed development. Apart from that, okay, I think there is a property agent, but you know, the last person you need for developing a good place is a property agent. Apart from that, I don't see any real expertise in urbanism, in creating good urban places. I don't see anybody there who knows about the history of the place. So I don't see people who are genuine representatives of the community. And as you say, no elected members. They're all just appointees and they were thrust upon us.
What about this style of doing things? Because, I mean, certainly when you were mayor, this isn't the way you got things moving, by simply appointing a group of people you think can make things happen. And I just wonder what you make of this style. I mean, we've also seen changes to the constitution of the city to give less power to the elected representatives, the councillors. Things seem to be moving in a more autocratic direction. And I think for many people, when they first had a mayor, George, they were worried that it was going to be putting too much power in one person's hands.
And you were one of those people who were worried about that.
Yes, nice. I wasn't the only one. It was actually quite a low percentage of people that actually came out to vote to have a mayor in the first place. So I just wonder what you make of the way that it's all panning out. I mean, I think, you know, most people would say things went reasonably well when you were in charge, but it's taking a bit of a new direction with the setting up these sorts of organisations which don't have elected representatives on them.
Yeah, I was incredibly fortunate. I was the only independent elected mayor of a major city in the UK, and the only independent in a major political position in the UK, really. And the great thing about being an independent is that you've got to involve others. Therefore, I had to set up a cabinet that was cross-party, that was a rainbow cabinet. I had to involve councillors from their areas and from different parties in decision making. I had to be scrutinised by those councillors on all the decisions that I took, and sometimes was ripped apart in the process. And so I think that was healthy. I think the problem is now that councillors, and including Labour councillors, I know that, a feeling that they are being left out. And I think that's really unhealthy. I mean, that's not good for our democratic system. And so I don't see a great advantage of having a very politicised mayor. I think I've seen some of the mayors of political parties virtually becoming independents. Ken Livingstone did become an independent, although he was always, you know, his heart was very much in the Labour Party. But, I mean, he acted in an independent way as the Mayor of London. And I think some of the Metro mayors are acting as independents to a large extent, like Andy Burnham in Greater Manchester and Andy Street. Andy Burnham's Labour, Andy Street's Tory. But they put their place first. They don't put their party first. And I think at the moment we are suffering terribly in Bristol from a very politicised mayor. And we also have a Metro mayor from the opposite party who is a nice man but not being very effective. And I think they are not helping each other. And I think now I've come to the conclusion that we'd be better off with a strong Metro mayor that represents the city region, like the good representation that Birmingham and Manchester both have, and dispense with Bristol having an elected mayor. And I've always thought that a Metro mayor was the right answer. We should be looking at city regional mayors, not competing mayors in the same region.
Now, I'm just finally getting back to this this possible development next to Arnold Feeney. I mean, this is something, surely, George, that if it goes ahead, I mean, that's that place lost, really, to the public.
Well, it is, and it is. It's an absolute peach of a site. I mean, we've kept that site, and it should be kept until something of public benefit goes on it. I'm not saying it needs to be 100% public benefit, but it should be, you know, I think that land, the space, you know, maybe underneath other uses, should be for public benefit. It has, you know, even just as an open space now, it's very much for public benefit. And I think it would be an absolute, you know, a appalling loss to the city. It is such a key position on that bend at the end of St. Augustine's Reach, going round into the main floating harbour, is absolutely key, which is why we had the plan to put the Centre for the Performing Arts there. I went to the Tate Gallery at the time I was mayor, suggesting that maybe they would like a Tate of the West there. I know there's a little Tate in St. Ives, but I just thought, yeah, and there's a Tate in Liverpool. I thought, you know, if one might put something there that worked across the water with Arnold Feeney. I also went to the Guggenheim and suggested that they might fund some a Guggenheim there. Now, neither had the appetite to do it, but I think it needs that sort of thinking, not just to give it over to being just yet another commercial development. I think that would be a criminal loss.
Is there anything that we can do? Because it seems a lot of these sorts of decisions are like this one being done in secret. Anything we can do to kind of keep on top of this? Because, I mean, if this is happening in secret, it's almost as if it's the council has become some sort of commercial operation, almost like a business.
Well, I don't understand why more fuss is not being made by councillors. Maybe they've just given up because they despair of being able to change things. I don't understand why a bigger fuss is not being made by councillors about this. There's something funny going on. Yes, I think there ought to be an absolute uproar, media and political uproar, about this whole project getting this far without us as citizens knowing about it.
Well, that's the former mayor of Bristol, George Ferguson, there. Now, I have to say, I'm always asking Marvin, texting him and emailing him, Marvin Rees, the Labour mayor, to come on the show and explain himself, particularly when it comes to these kinds of secret decisions. But this, Martin, really is an insult. The idea that a piece of land that's been being kept for cultural use in the city has been secretly to a few cherry-picked, hand-picked developers, they've been offered quietly without the public knowing to put various options on it, and a decision has been made behind closed doors. Now, this is secrecy, and this is our public space. So as a Labour mayor, you know, this is not really a Labour policy, I would have thought.
Well, I'm very interested to hear all this conversation, because a lot of this stuff is new to me. Although I've heard
it isn't really, is it? We had exactly the same George process. About we had the same process up at Temple Meads with what they call Temple Island there. Again, secret process. The contract or the land just simply awarded to somebody. In that case, I can't remember who it was, but this is the way things seem to be going now. I would suggest, you know, we heard quite a lot about John Savage there, the former master of the Merchant Venturers, the former right-wing Labour member who he was a member of the Labour Party anyway, who resigned when Jeremy Corbyn became leader. And it does seem to me as if this is Savage's project. It's Savage's book from 2010, not really Marvin Rees's idea when he was elected in 2016. It's more Savage.
Well, I think that to cut to the nub of the matter, elected mayors were a fad of the Cameron Conservative government, but the idea was that once you've elected the mayor, they then decide everything, and there's a real question about whether local councillors have any purpose at all.
I don't think anyone is quibbling, and George isn't there either, about the mayor making the final decision. But the idea is that it's a bit like China, actually, and their national security law. We're told what's happened afterwards. There's no possibility for any kind of scrutiny beforehand. Now, that doesn't sound very Labour. It doesn't sound very democratic to me.
Well, I don't believe in elected mayors. When Ken Livingstone, who was mentioned by George, was running the GLC in the 1980s, he wasn't an elected mayor. He was the leader of the Labour group on the council, on the GLC. And Livingstone is on the record as saying, I don't believe in elected mayors. I don't believe in elected mayors. I think that George there has obviously got to, you know, he's a bit frustrated because he used to run the city and now he doesn't. But at the same time, he pushed for the idea of elected mayors. And the problem with elected mayors is that they are designed to be autocrats. That was the whole idea. And that the idea is once you've got an elected mayor, they're going to bulldoze stuff through, get rid of all, you know, that's what the Conservative
government. I mean, Martin, let's just get back to what I said a moment ago, because what I'm saying is that the secrecy isn't necessary unless
Stifle debate. Isn't necessary, Tony, but it's there, written into the. Marvin is within his rights to do all of this. He shouldn't be.
So he's running the city.
Mayors shouldn't have those powers.
So
but they
if
do.
He's going to run the city like a business, is it a farm? Are we his little farm animals?
Well, he's designed to be a CEO of Bristol Incorporated. That's what mayors are supposed to be. That was the original conception behind the Tory idea of mayors, which they'd taken from the United States of America. Now, I don't agree with mayors. I don't think there shouldn't be. What's obviously happening now, we talked earlier about the finances of the council becoming completely destabilised. And, of course, there's a solution to that, which is because business rates are going to be in the hands of the council that once says they were taken. I mean, that's what gave Ken Livingstone such power in the early 80s, is he still had control of business rates. So he could whack a business rate on the City of London, and he's got a huge slush fund to spend on whatever he wants. And, of course, the Tories got rid of him, got rid of the GLC, got rid of the business rates, and the business rates were now paid into central government, and then all money for local authorities
But hang on. What about this? The Western Harbour Board, one of the people sitting on it, for example, is the regional boss of Wilko Stores, you know, the hardware chain. Yes. Now, what are they going to be supplying the spanners to build the houses? Why are they there?
Basically, what you're delineating there is a pro-business, pro-development agenda. And, of course, why a Labour mayor may be drawn in that direction is because it can plug. If you've got lots of commercial property, you can then get the business rate money from that, and you can then pursue whatever little pet projects you've got.
So I suppose the council's attitude is, look, we need loads more things we can tax, like little rabbit hutch houses.
That's right. And of course, because there's no fairness in the distribution of resources at local or national level. I mean, the Tories are rewriting now the standard spending assessments to rebalance it in favour of rural areas. So the money that central that local authorities get is based on an index of deprivation I actually used this index of deprivation when I was doing some analysis for Bristol Debt Advice Centre a decade ago. And the point is they're now rejigging it so that rural areas, which obviously tend to be more prosperous areas, are going to get more money and inner cities are going to get less. And ultimately, you've either got to fund local authorities through local taxation, local income tax, rates, something like that, or it has to be funded by central government. Central government basically is cutting off. They've reduced the money available to local authorities enormously in the recent years. And the only solution from one point of view is just to allow, especially a city like Bristol, which is so relatively successful, is let development rip, and then you'll get some resources from taxing those developments.
Yeah, it would be lovely to ask Marvin Rees. Would be lovely to ask Marvin Rees what he makes of that. See if he's channeling John Savage, or maybe having both of them on.
Well, I mean, don't forget if the council's going bankrupt anyway, what options have you got? Yeah. What options are there?
There is corruption.
We've all been forced into
a whiff of corruption
by central government.
There's a whiff of corruption in much of this, particularly when business friends are given contracts or offered contracts behind closed doors. And that came up at Prime Minister's Questions this week when they were looking at local government fraud.
Duncan Baker. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Following the publication of MHCLG's report on the 8th of June into the risks of fraud and corruption in local government procurement, does the Prime Minister agree that procurement fraud betrays the taxpayer? It erodes public trust in our democratic systems, and we should take firm action against those that waste our public money.
Yes. Prime Minister.
I certainly do, Mr. Speaker, and I think that fraud is corrosive of public trust and wasteful of public money, and it is absolutely vital that all councillors learn the lessons of that report, and I thank him for drawing it to the attention of the House.
So the temptation is to award certain contracts to certain people without going through the proper process, in certainly no public process, which is what happened down at Temple Island. It's also happened at Cannon's Marsh with this, apparently, according to George there, and our little exclusive. But also, Martin, we've got another problem, haven't we? And that is that this company Into has gone bust that runs these big shopping centres like Cribbs Causeway. So is it just a question of them changing hands and we won't notice any difference? Or does it matter if a big chain like this goes bust?
Well, there's two separate strands there. Of course, what's going to happen is there's going to be massive economic restructuring, and that's putting it mildly. I mean, we're basically heading into a property crash and mass unemployment. And, of course, that's going to basically unbalance the books of local authorities. It may well be that all these schemes for development, like the massive tower that's being built next to Castle Park, it may well be that the line of credit for that will run out before it's even built. That's how serious the situation is. And, we're going to be in crisis management mode from here on in.
What about something like Hinkley? You know, that's a even bigger, isn't it? A massive project, yeah, which is half built now.
Yeah, but of course, what you've got, because that's basically central government driven, you may find that, when Boris Johnson was talking about build the other day, he means things like HS2 and that. Now, of course, I would argue that they are white elephants and never going to make any money, which is another reason why it may not happen. So, well, we may find a situation where we're not actually doing anything very much because the money's simply not there because there's been a...
Well, not according to Boris, and that speech you were mentioning this week, it was, a sort of we're coming out of lockdown speech, really, and saying that not only are we doing that, but we're also planning, and this is the amazing thing, to do something like the New Deal of FDR. Now, is he just exaggerating there? Is there any possibility? Because this is the sort of thing you've been talking about doing for years, Martin. Finally,
Prime Minister is saying
we need FDR back again.
Well, what he's doing is he's grabbing the name of FDR off the shelf. But, of course, the amount of money that FDR spent was absolutely enormously more than he's talking about. The other thing that FDR did, he set up the Pecora Commission, which basically sent loads of bankers to prison and all sorts of stuff like that. They encouraged trade unions. to form in industries where they weren't, where they're being repressed. There was a wave of strikes which were backed by the government.
And there was an Boris attempted Johnson coup. There was an attempted coup against him too, wasn't there?
There was an attempted coup against him by Prescott Bush and others. Boris Johnson is basically, he's a lightweight, frankly, and he's gesturing in the direction of something.
But anyway, let's have a think. He's got no real commitment. What he had to say earlier this week.
This moment also gives us a much greater chance to be radical and to do things differently, to build back better and to build back bolder. And so we will be doubling down on our strategy. We will double down on leveling up, if you can make sense of that. And when I say level up, I don't mean attacking our great companies, or I don't mean impeding the success of London, far from it, or launching some punitive raid on the wealth creators. I don't believe in tearing people down any more than I believe in tearing down statues that are part of our heritage, let alone a statue of our greatest wartime leader. I believe in building people up, giving everyone growing up in this country the opportunity they need. Whoever you are, whatever your ethnicity, whatever your background, and there are certain things that are indispensable for that opportunity. Hospital you're born in, schools you go to, the safety of the streets where you grow up. And this government has not forgotten that we were elected to build 40 new hospitals. And we will. Matt Hancock is setting out the list in the next few days, and that is just the beginning. We will continue and step up the biggest ever programme of funding the NHS. And we won't wait to fix the problems of social care that every government has flunked for the last 30 years. We will end the injustice that some people have to sell their homes to finance the cost of their care while others don't. And we're finalising our plans, and we will build a cross-party consensus. We want to look after those who have looked after us. And at the same time, we will build the foundations now for future prosperity to make this country a Britain that is fully independent and self-governing for the first time in 45 years, the most attractive place to live, to invest, to set up a company, with the most motivated and highly skilled workforce. And so we're investing massively now in education, with over £14 billion for primary and secondary education between now and 2023. And today, with a new 10-year school building programme, beginning now with £1 billion for the first 50 schools, and a vast £1.5 billion programme for refurbishing our dilapidated FE sector, dilapidated in many places, not here, of course. Because it's time. It's time that the system recognised that talent and genius are expressed as much by hand and by eye as they are by a spreadsheet or an essay. So when I say unite and level up, when I say build up people and build up talent, I want to end the current injustice. That means a pupil from a London state school is now 50% more likely to go to a top university than a pupil from the West Midlands. And that is not only unjust, it is such a waste of human talent. We will unleash the potential of the entire country. And that means basic things, cracking down again on the crime that blights too many of our streets and too many lives. And we'll get on with our plan to recruit 20,000 more police officers. We've already found 3,000 or recruited 3,000. And I thank the police again for everything they're doing and have done in this crisis. And we will back our police all the way and give our justice system the powers we need to end the lunacy that stops us, for instance, deporting some violent offenders, just as we've already stopped the automatic early release of terrorists. We'll make this country safer. We will build the hospitals, build the schools, the colleges, but we will also build back greener and build a more beautiful Britain. We will protect our landscape with flood defences and plant 30,000 hectares of trees every year, creating a new patchwork of woodlands to enchant and re-energise the soul. And in those towns that feel left behind, we have plans to invest in their centres, new academy schools, new green buses, new broadband, and we want to make them places where people have the confidence to stay, to raise their families, to start businesses, and not to feel that all the action is in the cities or in the metropolis.
So that's Tory Prime Minister Boris Johnson speaking early this week in Dudley, Martin. Just in a nutshell, you think it's all just hot air?
Largely. And of course, the real problem is we've had 10 years. You mentioned police officers there. They sacked 20,000 police officers. And now
this is a new government, though, isn't it?
Well, it is, but it's the same party in power. And the austerity of the last, I mean, why has the NHS not been prepared for this pandemic? Because it's been starved of money because we bailed the banks out. And of course, the underlying
Gordon Brown did.
Well, Gordon Brown, not George Brown. George Brown's from the 1960s.
Gordon Brown did that, yeah.
Gordon Brown did that. And of course, we did that. When you bail the banks out, we should have taken control at that point and put in place a new deal.
Well, we didn't take control. We just didn't use it, did we?
We haven't used it. And of course, what's happened is that the banks have collapsed again and been bailed out again. And of course, what he's talking about there is he's going to fund all of this by borrowing. Now, that's all very well when interest rates are at zero, which is what they are at the moment. Although, of course, you could always have borrowed during the last 10 years. There was no reason for austerity in the last 10 years. But what may happen now with a no-deal Brexit is there'll be a run on the pound, and then they'll have to raise interest rates in order to protect the currency, and we'll just fall down into a massive crash, which will only be dealt with by massive investment, which will involve raising taxes on the wealthy. And they've got to face this up. The wealthy are made out like bandits in this coronavirus crisis in Britain and elsewhere.
I mean,
only become because the state has stepped in
that they shouldn't be trying to balance the books. They should be spending and borrowing, and that's what he's doing.
Yes, but you spend and borrow, but you can only do that to a certain extent. And the reason you won't, it's not enough. You've also got to actually rebalance the tax system. So in the 1950s, when we fought the Battle of the Imjin River in North Korea, when we were invading North Korea, and we also built up the health service, the top rate of tax in this country was 95%. And everybody thinks, well, that's ridiculous. You can't have a 95% tax rate. You can. We did.
Yep.
We did.
And maybe, who knows, maybe at some point we will. Anyway, thanks to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers there. Just join us in a minute as we take our weekly look around the world. First, some music. Thank you.
So that is Hawkwind from 1988, Hassan Isaba from Quark, Strangeness and Charm. Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. After Putin's big World War II speech last week, this week he successfully changes the Russian constitution in a referendum to allow himself to stay in power for another decade. Why do those stupid Russian people keep voting for him? Have they been brainwashed? Or have we? And China brings in its new national security law in Hong Kong, effectively ending the one country, two systems, which is supposed to last until 2047. Well, we're not even halfway there from 97, when Chris Patton handed over Hong Kong to China, and free expression as well as the right to peaceful protests gone overnight. Not much left now. It's only that Chinese troops, many of whom see Hong Kongers as agents of the West, aren't yet on the streets. We speak to two Hong Kongers from Bristol, one student and one person that works here. And they've obviously been in touch very, very closely with this. The Bank of England won't hand over £1 billion in gold to Venezuela, which they have on deposit at the bank. So the bank thinks that Guaido should be president, not Maduro. So is it up to the Bank of England, who wins an election in Venezuela? Can anyone trust the old lady of Threadneedle Street again? And as construction of the Nord Stream 2 passes Denmark, this is one of Martin's favourite subjects, the Nord Stream 2, and approaches North Germany, ready to supply Europe with cheap Russian gas, so America slaps new sanctions on, and Germany is not impressed. Also, the pharmaceutical industry suffered a blow, not being able to smuggle their mandatory vaccine schemes, the laws for them, passed under cover of the pandemic, giving us more time to find out if the information isn't smothered by their propaganda or censored off the air, as we've been, to find out what they're up to and how they care more about their profits than our health. And finally, Newgenics and the Algorithm Ghetto, the author of IBM and the Holocaust, Edwin Black, he reflects on what he sees as a Nazi-style agenda behind the coronavirus hysteria. But we've got to start this week, Martin, haven't we, with the arrest of Ghislaine Maxwell. I remember being told years ago that the reason that even though the list of Jeffrey Epstein had been made public with all these children being trafficked, that the US Justice Department didn't arrest her or Epstein because they were said to be hands off. Now, it's all very well. I mean, how do you get one of these get out of jail free cards? How did Epstein and Maxwell get away with it for so long?
Well, as you say, they were very well connected. So, you know, they felt invulnerable because they basically got all of these very powerful guys in their entourage. And of course, the main thing about all of this, which most people aren't picking up on, is they were basically agents for the Israeli state. And that were doing what they were doing.
Do you have any evidence for that?
Yes, Ghislaine Maxwell's father, Robert Maxwell, was a well-known Mossad agent. There's all sorts of evidence piled up about this. And Epstein also. And
it doesn't mean to say she is, does it?
Well, no, it doesn't. But I'm just pointing out there's plenty of evidence to suggest that this is what was going on. This is what the motivation is. These guys don't just end up having sex with underage girls just because they like having sex with underage girls, although many middle-aged blokes do. The point is that they were being blackmailed. That's what this is all about.
It was an entrapment operation, really.
Entrapment operation, absolutely. And they've got, you know, they're basically all these parties that they ran on various islands and in their big houses and so on. They were videoing and basically, there's a really good analysis of this on Mint Press by Whitney Webb. It was all linked into the mafia's entrapment of people in going back to the 60s and the 50s. This is a standard intelligence service procedure. It's pretty easy to do. The Franklin scandal in the US was a similar one. And of course, the whole point is that they do have to be underage so that you can blackmail people with the consequences.
Well, I mean, people might even say that the Jimmy Savile scandal was connected to that sort of thing, because as he had so many high level connections, for example,
this is the Bishop
of Gloucester and Prince Charles, etc.
Yeah. I mean, basically, the strategy of intelligence agencies is to compromise everybody, get the dirt on everybody. Because once you've got dirt on them, you can then steer them in any direction you want them to go.
And now you hinted at this, but the key bit of evidence here, of course, is these video recordings. There was a little room in Jeffrey Epstein's New York house where everything, every room, there was a constant recordings going on. So I wonder where those recordings are now. And never mind Ghislaine Maxwell. Obviously, she will be very interesting to see if she gives testimony, if she survives, as obviously Jeffrey Epstein didn't, to give that testimony in public court. Well, first of all, what do you think about that? Is she going to survive? Is she going to spill the beans in court?
Well, that's imponderable. It may be that she will, in order to get a softer sentence, she will point the finger at various other people who are involved. But I think it'll be up to people like us to keep banging on about what's underlying all of this, which is Mossad intelligence operation.
Well, that's interesting, because what you seem to be suggesting is that now Trump and the United States has got a bit of leverage with the Israelis.
Well, not really. I mean,
if they allow this to go to court, et cetera, and all this to come out, surely this is going to look bad for Israel. If you're right, and she was working with Mossad or for Mossad, this is not going to look good for the Israelis, is it?
But the point is that they've got all the tapes on all these people. There are pictures of Trump, Clinton, everybody in bed with Ghislaine Maxwell and Epstein. And therefore, they're in a strong position for this to be hushed up. And deal will be done, you can be sure.
Yeah, maybe it may well be. Yes, a bit of a plea bargaining going on, maybe.
Well, exactly. That's what will happen. They will basically, we will never get to the bottom of this. They've got too much on all the different people involved.
Well, that's right. There's much, much more to come, potentially. This is the question, isn't it? But it's a little bit like the scandal we covered years ago, to do with the MP's expenses. Well, once you've got that hard drive, and I'm suggesting here, you know, once you've got the hard drive with all these videos on, with all these famous people, rich and powerful people, having sex with minors potentially, or in that state of some sort, suddenly you can then start releasing that willy-nilly. You know, you can put it out,
it willy-nilly, do you? What you do is you go to the people involved in the case and you say, you don't want this stuff coming out, do you? And it's not going to, because you're just going to sweep this under the carpet.
It actually could still be a very powerful blackmail tool. Now, we know that there were certainly lots of other people on that Lolita Express, other names of very powerful people who there may be footage of still to come.
Yes, and it'll be interesting to see how far they go with this.
Well, what's happened with Andrew so far? Prince Andrew, he's done a very embarrassing interview. We've heard about him having sex with a girl who wasn't underage. I mean, that doesn't to me look like it could be. There's a lot more to come out of this can of worms rather than just Prince Andrew, which is all we've heard so far.
Well, Prince Andrew is a fairly low level operative. Let's face it, it's much more important to blackmail people like the President of the United States or the heads of big corporations.
But the point here is surely that, once Andrew has been rinsed in public, everyone else's minds are focused on making sure that their blackmail, when the blackmail letter arrives, that they do as they're told.
Yeah. And basically, a lot of the people who have been blackmailed through this process are probably not well known to the general population. And the reason why we pick up on people like Prince Andrew is because he's somebody that we know. Yeah. But of course, the purpose of the blackmail is not always to get blackmail the people who've got some kind of public profile. There'll be plenty of people that they've drawn in who haven't got a public profile
at all. And the way that blackmail works, of course, is that most of the time the person being blackmailed does what they're told, and so it's never made public.
Well, exactly. That's the whole point of it, isn't it? I mean, what we're really talking about here is steering policy in favour of things like invading Iraq. You can imagine you can approach somebody in the Congress and say, it looks like you're thinking of voting against the invasion of Iraq. Well, think again, because we've got this video of you. That's the sort of thing.
Now, you mentioned Whitney Webb. What's the main take home about her research on Epstein and what was going on there?
She's done a very good series of in-depth articles looking at the whole use of blackmailing tactics going back to the 40s and the 50s. And basically, J. Edgar Hoover, head of the FBI, was blackmailed by the mafia because he used to like dressing up as a woman, which, of course, is not a big deal, but it was a big deal back then. And they're basically, it's linked to people like Meyer Lansky and other big crime figures, crime boss figures from that era. And of course, many of these people were Jewish and were Zionists, as well as being gangsters.
Bill Clinton apparently was one of those that ditched his Secret Service on multiple trips on the Lolita Express. So he told his Secret Service to stay away, hopped on Jeffrey Epstein's plane and off to his island many times.
Well, that's right. And so when all of that will end up in the hands of the Israeli intelligence services so that they can make sure that Clinton does what they want him to do.
Well, another one that's on the list is Alan Dershowitz. These are very, very wealthy, powerful people, particularly in the United States, Martin. It seems they were all flying on this Epstein jet
I think that Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell's task was to entrap as many people as possible. So, you know, get them all, you know. We're not targeting any specific individuals here. And of course, because she was so well connected with the royal family and the social sets of people like Trump and Clinton and so on, it's perfect. You know, and there's very big questions about where Epstein's money came from. He was supposedly this big hedge fund manager, and that's why he was so wealthy to throw all these lavish parties. But it wasn't clear that he did any actual work, and it may well be that he was set up as to do exactly that, what's been done, which is to run all of this underage sex rings and blackmail everybody involved in it.
Well, I think I should definitely put a link up to an article, or maybe some of the photocopies or whatever of the list of who was flying on this Lolita Express. But we know, don't we, also that both Bill Gates and Richard Branson were on that plane at various times. So these are the sorts of names that they may be being asked to be obedient to, keep quiet about X or Y and not to say things that they intended to say in order to keep them quiet.
Yeah, well, I imagine Ghislaine Maxwell has been protected up to now by intelligence services. So but some deal will be done, or she will just, like Epstein himself, commit suicide, possibly. Who knows? But there's plenty of dirt there. And it's, you know, you've got to presume that it's in the hands of the Israelis, who are basically planning for a major war in the Middle East. So they'll get that dirt out and make it work for them, won't they?
Okay, well, I'll put some links up to that on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. I think it's also, we also ought to look at the constitutional changes in Russia, Martin. Putin really does seem to be surfing away over there with actually a genuine amount of public support, or is it that he's got a very good domestic propaganda machine?
Well, as I say, I did an interview about this yesterday on RT. If you look at the results, nearly 80% of the population participated in the poll.
Wow, that's the sort of participation we could
So it's more like 70%. It was a 70%.
Well, even that, we don't get that.
That's quite high. About 27%, nearly less than a third, voted against. So the idea that it's a rigged poll, you remember the sort of polls that people used to have, and 99.9% in favour. Just less than one in three voted against.
You mean like Crimea?
Well, no. Well, we'll come back to that in a minute.
I think you're right. That was probably a genuine poll, actually.
Well, that was a genuine poll. This was a genuine poll. In actual fact, one of the points I made is that you can see it's a genuine poll because there's a fairly substantial no vote. Gennady Zyuganov, who was once a presidential candidate for the Communist Party, and the Communist Party called for a no vote. So the communist voters, if they were loyal to their party, voted against. But of course, they are the main opposition in Russia. But even so, they're not big enough.
Video's up on YouTube, Martin, it would be quite interesting to see if they've edited that out, because that's what they used to do with me. If I ever mentioned the Communist Party, it would never appear on RT.
Well, it was a live interview, so there you go. But in any case,
what I'm saying is they edit it out of the. They tend to edit it out of the YouTube video.
Well, that may be so, but I don't suppose they're going to make a YouTube clip of it anyway. The point is that the Communist Party, quite, you know, perfectly within its rights, call for a no vote. Their voters probably did vote no, and of course in the West that's right because on all the foreign policy issues like Syria, Ukraine, the Communist Party is more militant than Putin. but they're not happy with Putin having all of this power. But I think what Putin's done here is, because he's coming to the end of his legitimate term, if they don't create the possibility of him having a further term, then the politics in Russia starts to become destabilized, because everybody starts to look who's coming after Putin. And at the moment, the United Russia, which is the dominant hegemonic force in Russian politics, they basically passed this through the Duma anyway. It's not just about him extending his terms. There's various other aspects to this. So they've put a minimum wage guarantee into the constitution. They've effectively banned same-sex marriage. They've shifted the power between the president and the Duma. So from now on, the prime minister will be selected by the Duma, not by the president. The president can still veto it, but basically they're shifting power more to the legislative and away from the president.
Well, that's good to hear. I mean, also
the purpose of that is because Putin realizes he can't run a one-man band forever. He's got to build a wider network of support in the society.
I mean, it sounds like a great, very worry wise chap. But I mean, things like the not allowing same-sex marriage, I mean, that isn't necessarily the sort of thing that people in this part of the world would support. And I think it's interesting the influence of the Orthodox Church possibly coming in there.
Yeah.
But I don't know if you've seen it, that just today on the BBC, the coronavirus-denying Father Sergei has been expelled by the Russian Orthodox Church. This is a Russian Orthodox cleric, Father Sergei, whose actual name is Nikolai Romanov, took over Sredenusk convent near Yekaterinburg in the Urals on the 16th of June, posting armed guards there, saying the church said he'd broken monastic rules. He called the COVID-19 crisis a pseudo-pandemic and cursed those who ordered that church services be stopped on health grounds. So he's saying we are going to have armed guards in our church and we are going to make sure that services continue.
Well, and he's obviously annoyed various bigwigs in the Orthodox Church and no doubt the Russian government. He's a maverick. That's what he sounds like.
Yeah, not just that. There have also been complaints of child abuse at the convent under Father Sergei's leadership, and the church court called for a thorough investigation of the allegations by the Russian authorities. The church is also carrying out its own investigation, apparently. But it sounds awful. I hope we don't have a shootout at the convent with the father and the Russian troops. But generally speaking, though, Martin, with the Russians, if we're looking at this confrontation brewing between China and the United States, and it certainly is, I mean, John Pilger's film, The Coming War on China, is a very powerful explanation of why that does look like it's more likely rather than less likely. It's certainly be inching towards it rather than just simple, news lines and saber rattling. But the Russians actually could play quite a key role if America and China start fighting.
They could, and one of the complications in that is that the Chinese and Indian face-off in Ladakh, the Russians are one of the main weapons suppliers to the Indians. So this then places they're still saying that they'll supply weaponry to India, even if they go to war with China in Ladakh. And, of course, they're being pushed to go to war with China by the Americans, who are looking for a war with China, as John Pilger pointed out. But the Russians fight, the Americans love this because it puts Russia and China at odds. But I think the overall strategic direction of Russian and Chinese policy is definitely to try and coordinate, because they recognize that they're both being targeted by the neocons in the US, and that basically both military in China and in Russia are preparing for war, and as is every other military, because that's how stupid the Western leadership is.
I mean, the West seems to have taken a very negative line towards Russia, particularly. I mean, we've been covering the whole Skripal case and all the myriad holes that, like a sieve, in that story. But this week we hear, don't we, that the Bank of England, they're refusing to hand over $1 billion in gold to Venezuela, even though it's their money, because they don't agree with the way the election went. Well, we've seen a sort of similar thing we were talking about just now about Crimea. The West thinks that that's been annexed. It doesn't agree that the referendum that was held in Crimea, whatever it was, perhaps 6-7 years ago now, was fair. They've said the same now about Venezuela. And as a result, they're saying, well, actually, we will only hand over the money if Guaido is in charge.
Well, Guaido, of course, has become increasingly isolated because of the, you know, the attempted coup attempt by the mercenaries, which the Venezuelan armed forces dealt with pretty firmly.
The Americans, yeah, they tried a coup attempt, didn't they?
Yeah. Well, Guaido has never stood to be president of Venezuela. He's never stood in a presidential election. He's basically the leader of a small faction within the opposition in Venezuela, and it's quite interesting what's happening there, because quite a substantial section of the opposition in Venezuela are basically talking to the Maduro government and are going to participate in upcoming elections. But the far right, Guaido and others, and their supporters in the West, don't want any kind of participation in elections in Venezuela, the reason being, of course, that they can't win. But the more moderate opposition, I mean, and they've done opinion polls inside Venezuela, 80% plus of the population do not want sanctions on Venezuela. They recognise that this is making the population, the situation with the population, worse and worse.
Well, it's quite obvious
the British are involved in an attempt to overthrow the democratically elected government of Venezuela.
They just want the oil,
British,
I suppose.
British frigates are out there attempting to threaten them as we speak.
Well, we want the oil, I suppose. We want to control that oil, don't we?
No, we want to do what the Americans want us to do. We're not going to get the oil. That's going to go to the Americans. But, I mean, the point is that the British are, and of course what they've done here with the Bank of England, is the British are showing their slavish support for US policy, even when US policy is completely wrong.
But there may be a price to pay, mightn't there, from the Bank of England. But loads of, say, for example, non-aligned countries, places like Singapore, people like that, will be thinking, right, we better pull our money out of the Bank of England then.
Well, I mean, I think that's possibly what the signal is supposed to. Don't give us your money because you won't get it back. And that's all very well, but they may find further down the line that's what's going to happen. Venezuelan government resources have been impounded by Trump, and he's using them to build his wall with Mexico. Incidentally, they're planning to get rid of the recently elected Mexican president, López Obrador, because he's allowed Evo Morales, who's elected president of Bolivia, to escape to exile in Mexico. And now Trump and his minions are determining that they're going to get rid of...
Well, that's funny, isn't it? Because the other week we covered the US report that said actually that it was a free and fair election, so he should go back to Bolivia.
Well, indeed. So in other words, the Americans are back to their old tricks of overthrowing democratic governments in Latin America. They've done it in Paraguay. They've done it in Honduras. They're trying to do it in Venezuela. They did it in Bolivia.
Some would say Brazil as well.
In Brazil as well. And Britain, super democratic Britain, is going along with all of it. And of course, as I said, we've got a frigate out there helping the Americans to supposedly interdict the oil coming from Iran, or to arrest Maduro for being a narco terrorist or whatever. What may happen is a British sailor is going to be shot through the head by a Venezuelan military person defending their country, and we're going to be at war with Venezuela. We better find out what Boris thinks about that, eh?
Another country whose money we refused to give back was the Gaddafi and the Libyans, wasn't it? So yeah. I wonder if we could skip ahead a little bit and have a look at one of the Prime Minister's questions that came up this week, because the running sore in Libya is absolutely horrific. Now we've removed Colonel Gaddafi, that so many people said, oh, you know, Gaddafi's got to go. The country is now an absolute basket case. Many people hungry, starving. It's basically like mob rule, gangster rule, with whole armies of people sort of vying for control of major cities, of airports and that sort of thing. I mean, it's just complete chaos there. But one thing that did come up was the murder of PC Yvonne Fletcher at Prime Minister's Questions this week. So I think, you know, this is one of the things we cover quite regularly on here, Martin, isn't it? These the twisted way in which Gaddafi was demonised by the British, or by certainly by the British government, if not partly by the British press, all except the Channel 4's dispatches, Fulcrum Films, back in the 1990s, did a brilliant two-part documentary explaining why the Libyans did not kill PC Yvonne Fletcher. But let's have a listen now to Prime Minister's Questions, which looks, I mean, obviously Lockerbie is another thing we cover quite regularly on here, reminding everybody that the Libyans weren't responsible for that. It looks as if the United States was, and the same with the murder of PC Yvonne Fletcher in order to demonise Libya in the eyes of the public. Amazing, but true. So let's have a listen now to Prime Minister's Questions this week, where PC Yvonne Fletcher's case is raised.
Alan Dorrance.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. On the 17th of April, 1984, I was a serving police officer in the Metropolitan Police when WPC Yvonne Fletcher was shot and killed whilst on duty policing a demonstration outside the Libyan embassy in London. No one has ever been charged in connection with her death. In light of reports at the weekend about a civil case being brought by her former colleague, PC John Murray, against one of the main suspects, will the Prime Minister pledge to reopen the criminal inquiry into the murder of WPC Yvonne Fletcher?
Well, first of all, Mr. Speaker, I want to thank the Honourable Gentleman very much for his service in the police, and also to thank him for raising a very important subject that I've followed for many years, because the murder of WPC Yvonne Fletcher was sickening and cowardly. I think the best thing I can say to the Honourable Gentleman today is that I would welcome the opportunity to talk to him in person about the issue that he raises, to see what we can do to take the matter forward.
So a bit of shilly-shallying there by Boris. Let's go and talk about this privately and quietly, and maybe it will go away, Martin.
Yeah, well, that's because those who know that the Libyans didn't do it. And the people, I don't know if we can put links up to those dispatches documentary, but the second one was particularly important because it showed who did do it. And who did do it is, surprise, surprise, our own intelligence services working with the Americans. They killed a young police officer in order to make Margaret Thatcher adopt a more hostile attitude towards Libya. That's how wicked they are.
I mean, just briefly talk about the basics. Is the ballistics didn't work out, did
That's
they?
Right.
I mean, the bullet could not possibly have come from where the embassy was, and it came from the same square, but a neighbouring part of the square from a very high building. And it's very easy, actually, with the to follow the trace of the bullet through the body to prove that the Libyans didn't kill Yvonne Fletcher. Somebody else on a neighbouring building, which the Libyans weren't in and didn't control, was actually controlled by the British and US security services, that particular balcony, where that's where the bullet came from.
Yeah, and they have the SAS's ballistics expert saying that. I remember him saying, well, I'll tell you one thing, the Libyans didn't kill the police lady. That's the former head of ballistics for the SAS. And that's all in the programme. But, of course, what happens in our free society is this programme gets shown once, disappears down the memory hole, and everybody thinks they know what happened there. The evil Libyans killed Yvonne Fletcher, except they didn't. We did.
Okay, so I'll put a link up on our show page to Dispatches, Fulcrum Films, Murder in St. James, one of the last really good, powerful documentaries we had in this country, because I think it came out in the early 90s, and at the point where the documentaries and investigative journalism was being basically shut down in Britain. Anyway, I think it's time to go and have a look at Hong Kong now. I mean, there's lots and lots we could be talking about, but let's have a look at Hong Kong, because the whole change that's happened this week, I just thought it'd be interesting to run it past some Hong Kongers who live here in Bristol. You know, I've been hanging out with them over the years on and off, and I find them some of the nicest, most intelligent young people that it's possible to find around. You know, the idea that these people are now worried about potentially not wanting to go back home, well, that's basically what's happening now, because if they speak to us, they speak to the BBC or anybody else, they'll potentially they could be arrested on arrival. So anyway, let's have a listen now to my chat earlier on this week with two people from the Hong Kong community here in Bristol.
So the new Hong Kong national security law was introduced this week, and of course we do have quite a few Hong Kong students here in Bristol. They are going back to Hong Kong after they've finished either a year or just one term at the university here, to a rather different country, which China has got a lot more control on. And I'm joined on the line by Amy, who's 32. Hi, Amy.
I managed to get a job here and I live here in Bristol now.
You're part of a group with some other students. One who is a student is Tom. Hi, Tom.
Hi, I'm Tom and I'm a student here in Bristol. It's my second year here and I'm going to be here for 3 more years before I decide where to go.
So I suppose the first thing to look at is this new law that's been brought in, the National Security Law. Could we have a bit of an overview of what are the main points? Because the scary thing about it is until Wednesday morning, people didn't know anything about this law. So we have a very strange system going on in Hong Kong at the moment where laws are passed, but no one is allowed to know what they are until they're actually in force. I suppose we should be grateful that the government tells us what the law is, so we know whether we can we're going to be disobeying it or not. Amy?
So, yes, you're right. The law was passed with secrecy. No one in Hong Kong, not even the chief executive, know about it until just last night. And there is 4 main points from the law that we will get penalized for. So the first one is secession, so intent to break away from the country, such as things like asking for independence. Subversion, which is undermining the power of authority of the central government. It can include things like delaying the passing of a law, so there could be lots of things happening within legislative council, so if a debate can be criminalized. And then terrorism, so the law actually defines terrorism with a really broad stroke. It can be anything like vandalizing transport or even renting a venue to people who are related to terrorism activity. And also collusion with foreign forces, which is not defined very clearly in the law. We can well be in the edge of it right now talking to you.
Oh, dear. Not allowed to talk to foreign journalists. What a shame. So, look, what is it, do you think, that's prompted this law, Amy? Why is it now?
Obviously, there is mass unrest from June last year. So I think the Beijing government definitely wants more control over Hong Kong. And I have a lot of speculation that China is under a lot of economic pressure and also with trade war with the US. And that's why more control over Hong Kong has become their priority.
What do you think, Tom?
Yeah, so I think that this law has many reasons for it to be established. China in the past has tried multiple times to impose a law similar to this. We had the Rule 20 Article 23 about more than 10 years ago, which was protested by about 200,000 people on the streets that eventually got taken back by the Chinese government. And many more after that, for example, the Umbrella Revolution and just extradition law, which was successfully fought back by the people. But this is really about China stepping in to ensure the city has a legal framework to deal with whatever it sees as a serious challenge to its authority. And the most fearful thing, I think, about this article, about all these articles, is that there are very arbitrary descriptions of the laws. So essentially, China can use it to whatever they deemed dangerous, and they don't really need a valid excuse to arrest you anymore.
So there's a very wide terms that the law is interpreted. So you could maybe let one person go and say, well, this doesn't apply to you, and someone else it does apply to you. This is one of the problems, isn't there, with some laws, is that they throw the net very wide. And so that then becomes a little bit more like a kind of an authoritarian system where there's a lot of discretion given to the police. Anyway.
And just to show how broad the law is that a person was arrested this morning for having a flag inside his backpack. It's a flag. So the flag says Hong Kong independence, but the person wasn't showing the flag to anyone. It was only in his backpack and it was found because there was a stop and search. And he was arrested under the national security law.
But look, I understand also that non-Hong Kong citizens may be caught up in this law too. I wonder if either of you have got anything to say about that, which I find... So the idea is that, say, somebody like me may be caught up as a British citizen in the new national security law. How is that?
Yeah, so the Article 38 of the national security law states that any non-Hong Kong citizens not in Hong Kong who engages in acts prohibited in the NSL, which is completely defined by China, are deemed to have violated it.
So that's this national security law, NSL, yeah.
This is part of it. So the Article 38 out of 66.
So what does that mean? I mean, why? How can China? Surely you have a thing called legal jurisdiction. So your law can only apply to a certain border and a boundary. It can't surely apply to all parts of the world. Although, funnily enough, this is what the Americans have been trying to do. So may possibly be China responding to the US and their attempts to have US law imposed in other parts of the world. But what's the sort of thing that non-Hong Kong citizens might be possibly arrested for if they visit Hong Kong? So I'm supposing here that obviously they can't come out from Hong Kong and arrest you, or China and arrest you and take you back to China for trial, but you may unwittingly turn up or maybe even be a transit passenger through Hong Kong and suddenly be arrested for what sort of thing are we talking about here?
Yeah, so earlier on, we sort of mentioned the four things that would criminalize you. So it could be anything from assisting people who are doing the aforementioned crimes, or even like spreading words and that causes people to question the authority. It's something as simple as that.
Well, that's amazing, because that's what we do here all the time in Britain. It's just part of our culture. We're always questioning authority. So it sounds to me like quite a lot of Brits who are going through Hong Kong might possibly be at risk.
So we have to, it's a very good question about the Article 38. And we have to remember that this law has very arbitrary descriptions. And you can go as simply as liking a picture that contains certain slogans. And upon attempting to enter Hong Kong, you will face arrest just because you have done that. So it could be anything, really.
Okay, Amy, you wanted to come in there as well.
Yeah, well, I was sort of imagining things like, well, people like me who are fighting for Hong Kong people's right here in Bristol, that we're probably a target of this particular law, but I would imagine people who are assisting me, maybe if I talk to a government officer, then he can also be criminalized.
This is a complete and utter destruction, really, of freedom of speech. At least that's what's being attempted. But look, can you just put this in context, Tom? Because I know Britain handed Hong Kong over in 1997 to China as part of a long 100-year-old or 200-year-old agreement. Mm. So at the end of the day, surely, you know, there's some inevitability to this. Once Britain has handed it over to China, surely it's up to China to govern Hong Kong now.
So upon the handover, which was 1997 July, which is actually the same month as I was born, we signed Hong Kong, China and UK, they signed a treaty that ensures 50 years of one country, two system, which is what is being destroyed by the NSL, which is the national security law recently. To put this into perspective, I was born in the same month and I'm supposed to enjoy 50 years of one country, two system, whatever the separate system in Hong Kong is. But 27 years in advance, this is stripped away from me and from all the people in Hong Kong. And it is quite a devastating kind of situation right now, because we have fought so hard and all our five demands were within the boundaries of the law that is written under the treaty, the 50-year treaty.
Okay, but, you know, you take what I'm saying, it's China's prerogative. They've allowed over 20 years of two systems. Now they're saying, right, it's going to become like China.
Yeah, so I think you can say that, but it's also, we had a treaty, we had an agreement of 50 years. And if you're going to strip that away earlier, I think anyone has the right to fight for it, to fight for what they believe in. And I think the suppression of liberty and speeches is probably the worst thing that can happen to any culture, because you're suppressing ideas that could be beautiful, you know?
Well, can you just maybe say something, Amy, about what you think the difference between the character of the Chinese world and the Hong Kong world? Because I know for a lot of Hong Kong people, they feel Hong Kongers. They don't feel like Chinese.
Yes. Well, Hong Kong people have a lot of international relationship. I was just reading this morning that apparently 1 in 6 people will have some connections overseas. So this particular law punishes any foreign intervention, makes it really, really strange for people to navigate. And that's why we, Hong Kong people, have such a good understanding of the international community. We have people from all countries in Hong Kong.
So it seems to me saying that the Chinese are more insular and they're not really so much aware of what's going on in other parts of the world. I think there's also the question of the media, the mass media in Hong Kong and China. I mean, how do they represent what's going on in other parts of the world? Do you think they're reasonably fair or similar?
Yes. So you might encounter Chinese people on internet, but then actually, majority of Chinese people are within what they call the Great Chinese Firewall. So information cannot go in and out of China easily. China is actually one of the 2 or 3 countries that doesn't have Facebook. And the other country that doesn't have Facebook is Cuba. So you can imagine how close up China is. Just because the internet that China is enjoying might contain 1.4 billion people doesn't mean that they have the view of the world. I think when I encounter Chinese people, a lot of them feel like they know a lot about the world, or they are very affluent. But actually, when they start to understand the wider context, then they would realize it's not what it seems.
Another thing I would want to add about the difference between Hong Kong and China is that China has the new censorship, which is what we're talking about. The reason why I think that is such a important focus is because information is literally what changes people's mind and gives them new ideas. Any authoritarian states would like to control discussion. They want to have all the power, and it is how they keep their power, you know. They are going to take advantage of the fact that we're fighting slower or fighting less, expressing less of our ideas, and further impose policies to control the discussion. This suppresses the liberty of ideas and speeches, and you can just see Hong Kong slowly turning into authoritarian state because of that.
Yeah, I think a good example of that mindset is what happened during coronavirus, the beginning of it. When doctors who are fully qualified to talk about a virus are being shut up by the government, they were arrested, and eventually Dr. Li Wenliang died in the hospital. But the conversation is completely controlled by the state media. The state media only mentions how great the forces is combating the coronavirus, but never mention what actually went wrong in the beginning.
It doesn't sound like the free flow of ideas, certainly. I mean, although we here in Britain and in the United States, even President Trump complains about the fake news media. The media in this part of the world can be problematic too, but it seems even more so in authoritarian China. Now, look, what about demonstrations? I mean, we've seen hundreds of thousands of people on the streets in Hong Kong over the last 18 months or so, doing protests mainly about the extradition law, extraditing people from Hong Kong into China. And do you think, I mean, we've seen some demonstrations. Do you think that's it? Do you think the Chinese have now frightened people so much in Hong Kong that they won't come out on the streets?
That is not true at all. I think that's because this morning people are protesting this morning in Causeway Bay in Hong Kong. I don't have the exact number of people, but there is tens of thousands. I know people who went out there to shout. Yeah, there are several people that was arrested under the new national security law, but that is not stopping us.
the implementation of this law is quite obviously China's attempt to control people by fear. Sometimes fear is very helpful when you can act on it productively and constructively. And I think when you recede into the fear and give into it and no longer express your ideas, that is when the movement dies. That is when there's no more hope.
But there must be some people in Hong Kong right now who are thinking, right, well, I better be very careful what I say. You know, this is the effect that these sorts of laws have, isn't it? That people self-censor, so they check themselves before they express themselves.
Yeah, this is very evident in the recent disbanding of one of our activist groups, led by Joshua Wong and a couple other people. This group disbanded upon the release of the NSL. And a lot of people are citing that they're worried about their personal safety and their family. It is the reason why they disbanded, but they promised that they will be continue fighting on their individual front.
So this is Joshua Wong. He's the one with the famous slogan, Wong is white, I seem to remember. He's the guy who's been campaigning for many years. But surely, I mean, this is like a blow, isn't it? The idea that the political party Democisto, who was set up to create independence, is gone. I mean, that's surely a big blow, isn't it?
I completely agree. There are a lot of anxiety and just sadness floating around in Hong Kong. And it is really what was expected as we heard the news about this law. A lot of people are working on it, but what I would say is time and time again, China has threatened us with a law of similar kind of power functions. And every time it seems like the people has lost some ground, they stand back up eventually. And each time there are going to be voices like, this is going to be completely hopeless, we should stop fighting. But, you know, it is a decision to continue fighting for what you believe in. It is not an easy decision, but I think the majority of us will promise that if you decide to continue walking, we'll walk alongside you.
Amy, what about here in Bristol? Because I understand that there are actually campaigns here in Bristol with Hong Kongers and Chinese here in the city. Have you had experience of those campaigns?
Yes. So we had protests last year, I think around October to December. And there is a few times that we encounter Chinese students who hold opposite views. So what happened is that they seem to want to take pictures of us, spy on us on the side. And then there is another time where they hold out a really big Chinese flag and try to cover us from one side of the road, so, and play really loud music to cover our voices. So I think that kind of spying and photographing could be used for doxing and is another way of threatening us here.
So, what do you mean by doxing?
So, I think what happened is that they will post pictures of people who hold opposite view to China online, and they could be harassed online, and face different.
They can find all the information
bullying
about you and use those information against you. And sometimes when it gets too personal, it could have a very negative effect to a person.
So in a way, for Hong Kongers to come out on the streets of Bristol could be potentially dangerous when they return home. I mean, because if there are photographs being taken and passed to the authorities, these people have been part of some sort of demonstration in Bristol. Now, with the national security law, this is the sort of thing that could be used against you, maybe, Amy.
That's why most Hong Kong protests have been... Well, everyone who is in this Hong Kong protest were wearing masks last year. And people have continued to wear masks now for probably coronavirus or other reasons. But yeah, that's the only way we can protect ourselves.
Well, this is bringing this conflict that's going on 10,000 miles away, bringing it on right here into Bristol, which is rather worrying. What about the more personal side? And I'll ask you this first, Tom. Are you worried about going home now? I mean, is this something that's crossed your mind, that the trip back to Hong Kong might not be just the same as it always has been in the past?
I am not actually too worried about heading home and, you know, seeing everyone who shares the same belief as I do. The risk is always going to be there. What we can really do is try our best to protect ourselves by using anonymity, and just covering our faces, really, and being careful not to be too public about our ideas. One thing is I want to say is I am incredibly privileged and lucky to be comfortable staying in the UK for a longer period of time before I head back. But the reality is a lot of people don't have that choice. And a very common thing is you go back home and then your parents usually share a very different ideas than you do. And for some people, that could be a sign of conflict, a sign of argument. But there are cases where some parents would beat up their own child so badly because they share a different belief and went on the streets and all that. And these kids have to go to the hospital and cause them very severe emotional damage as well.
So, you know, it might not necessarily be a wonderful homecoming for some of the children. But what I'm trying to get at, and maybe you can address this, Amy, is that going home should be something we all look forward to. But maybe with Hong Kong, it might not be like that, particularly for Hong Kong students here in Bristol.
Yeah, I would agree that for us, if we're outspoken, then there is a risk of going home and actually end up in prison. But what I believe is that because I am here in the UK and I have this privilege to speak up and not have to face police brutality, then it is my duty to speak up. It is my duty to talk to my local MP, express my concerns, because people in Hong Kong have their voice stolen overnight. So I have this duty to do this, even if I cannot go back home, maybe one day. Well, I don't consider myself as that a prolific protester, but if one day I cannot go back home, then that is fine, because I believe I'm fighting for a bigger thing.
Also, I mean, people might wonder what is going to happen, because apparently there may be quite a lot of Hong Kong people coming to Britain, quite a lot of migrants, Tom. I mean, for example, the right wing here in Britain might be getting really annoyed about that, you know, particularly the far right, these sort of racist people might not like it. But I mean, what about that? Do you think we're going to see a wave of people coming to Britain from Hong Kong now?
Yeah, so just today, actually, which is Wednesday, the Foreign Secretary, Dominic Raab, announced that the plan for British overseas nationals and their dependents to be given the right to remain in the UK. This includes the right to work and study for 5 years, after which they will be able to apply for settled status, and after a year, seek citizenship. And this is very important, because in the coming years, the UK will likely see a large influx of people immigrating from Hong Kong. I think it is important to understand why this is happening. And this includes like high living costs and increasingly oppressive education regime. And the more alarmingly, the increasing influence from the mainland. These are all like really solid reasons. And I think if people understand all that, they will be more accepting of the idea of us emigrating.
So, Amy, do you think we're going to see a wave of people coming to Britain who just don't feel that they have freedom of speech in Hong Kong? They don't feel it's for them anymore?
Yes, definitely. I agree with Tom. I think one of the things that really concerns people around me, well, people my age are thinking, what will happen to their kid? Are they going to have this brainwashing kind of education? So they really want to escape Hong Kong.
We've also got a couple of controversial points to you both. One is that commentators have said that a lot of this has been caused by the United States arresting the financial officer of Huawei in Canada. And the whole thing has been precipitated really by the Americans, by saying, well, the boss of the Chinese company Huawei, which is one of the most important technology companies in Huawei, was arrested, Meng Wanzhou, in Canada. And there is a procedure now going through where she may be brought back to the United States for trial. And that quite a few commentators around the world are saying, well, China probably wouldn't have done any of this if the United States hadn't done that. So I'll just ask you, Amy, first, and then you, Tom, whether you think that there's any truth to that.
Yes. So I don't think what U.S. has done is enough to bring 7 million people into this totalitarian law. So what has happened in China has been in getting increasingly worse. The human rights condition, if you look at things that is happening in Xinjiang, what happened to Uyghur, they have been under oppression since 2013, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
So it is the new leader, Xi Jinping, that is changing the foreign policy and also its internal policy to its people. I don't think we can blame U.S. for arresting a criminal.
What about this whole idea of Xi Jinping? Apparently now if you criticize him, then you can be arrested in China. It seems almost like he's kind of the Pope. You know, it's almost a religious figure where, you know, in the Catholic Church, they always said, well, the Pope is infallible. The only other person, it seems, in the world that is infallible is President Xi. Tom, what do you make of this whole idea that maybe the Americans have precipitated this, or do you think it's just that China is becoming more authoritarian?
Well, if you look at the history, the recent history of Hong Kong, is that China has time and time again tried to interfere with our policies, tried to interfere with basically everything, education, which will shape the future of Hong Kong. They've continued to do this over the years. So I think a recent event that caused China to do this is invalid. It won't happen that way. And second of all, I think it's a very common accusation from the opposite party that we're funded by the US, we are infiltrated by spies from the other countries. That gets into the conspiracy territory, and there's no way for me to disprove that, and there's also no way for anyone to verify that. What I can say is, I can speak for myself, and I can speak on behalf on a lot of people, really, is that they believe in the liberty of speeches, the liberty of ideas. These are things we're after, and you know, there aren't a lot of things that would push us over the top. But China has time and time again failed us, and the government just shows they were never going to listen to us.
Amy, the British didn't give proper democracy. The British said that there was someone appointed by the Queen. I think it was the Governor General that would run Hong Kong, not the people. So why is it now suddenly Hong Kongers want democracy where the British never gave them that?
Yeah. So when I was in colonial Hong Kong, when handover happened, I was 10. So I have just a little bit of understanding of the colonial Hong Kong. And what I understand is they never try to take away our speeches. They'd never stop us from criticizing the British. And I know that people in Hong Kong used to call the Queen Si Tao Po, which means the big boss.
The big boss.
So it is not exactly flattering. And so we were having a degree of freedom and particularly financial freedom, and the economy really thrived in Hong Kong during the time. And also one of the person appointed to be the governor of Hong Kong started free education and public housing. And that is something that Hong Kong people never had. So I think, some people are thankful for that.
What about this social credit system in China? Because I think that's one of the other things that people in Hong Kong have been concerned about, is that there is this really an attempt to categorize every citizen as to how obedient they are. Is that something that you've looked at yourself, Amy? And do you think it's something that Hong Kongers will be concerned about?
Yes, I have read about the social credit system. It really is like basically Black Mirror coming true. So there is, one example is there is this MMA fighter based in Beijing, and his name is Su Xiaodong, and he basically fights some Chinese martial art master and defeat them. And that was deemed inappropriate because he's challenging the traditional Chinese art, and it was said that he had all his social credit deducted from him, and he cannot get on trains anymore. And now he can't even get online anymore because all his social media accounts were suspended.
Well, this is pretty frightening, Tom, isn't it? Because this is almost like this Nazi idea of the Untermensch. So you have certain people who are under people, and you have other people who are over, and you're separating the citizens into the so-called good citizens and the right citizens and the so-called wrong citizens, the bad citizens. We're even seeing that, understand, with the protests, where some protests are deemed by the Hong Kong government now to be good protests, and other protests are deemed to be bad protests. So they're not really looking at whether someone has a right to protest, as they will only have a right to protest if they're saying something which is pro-President Xi, pro-the Chinese government. So anyway, I wanted to just to ask you the same question about this whole social credit system, which is something which to me is almost like a hallmark of an Orwellian authoritarian country, and whether you have looked at it and what you think of it as someone who's born and bred in Hong Kong.
So I wouldn't say I have a full understanding of the social crediting system, but just as news censorship is about controlling discussion, I feel like social crediting system is also about having more control over the people. You're segregating people into different classes and just separate different ideas of people for the collaboration of ideas. And, you know, it's exerting more and more control, and it's really just serving the purpose of being an authoritarian state.
Okay, final question for both of you. This is a David and Goliath struggle. Amy, Hong Kong is a tiny, tiny part of China. How can Hong Kong ideas survive? Surely they're just going to be dominated by this massively powerful Beijing superpower.
I don't think that is true. From last year, Hong Kong people had been showing their courage, their creativity, their professionalism through different types of protests. We have a lot of protest art. We have 2 million people walking on the street. We show time and time again that we will let the fire engine and ambulance pass us, even though there are millions on the street at the same time. We show that we are an organized group. So the international community had been looking into us, and from now on, we seem to heard from government officials giving statement to China saying that they are basically breaching the Sino-British Joint Declaration. So I think there is still hope, and you can see people are still on the street now, even though they know that they can be in jail for life.
That's
for
right.
What they're doing now.
Amazing. And Tom, do you think it's going to be possible for Beijing to crush the spirit of the Hong Kongers?
I think that's definitely not possible. I feel like the people have a very strong bond and strong will to fight for what they want. This movement really encourages various way of protesting. So you can voluntarily come up with different artistic ways, or musical ways, or just using your occupation to the advantage, really. And it's nice because there's great support and great encouragement among protesters. We time and time again refuse to denounce ourselves from the actions of other protesters, even though we might not be completely in line with their actions. But we continue fighting the cause with our own ways, and it is a very nice way to unify Hong Kongers for the love for the city.
Now, Amy, I know you wanted to finish with a little statement, which is kind of almost like a cry for acknowledgement from around the world for what you're doing. So you please do that now.
Yeah. So we cannot stop criticizing the Chinese Communist Party in fear of the national security law, or because losing a business partner, because what we're losing now is worth far more than it is the freedom and the life of millions of people under the communist regime that's being damaged here. If we continue to act on fear, if we are afraid of China, then Hong Kong will truly be a dead city. So people all around the world, you should stand up for Hong Kong people, because our voice is being stolen by them. I urge you to go on Twitter to write to your MP and voice your concern about Hong Kong. We need all the country to fight against this one totalitarian rules. We have to tell China loud and clear that they're overstepping the line. We cannot let them do whatever they want to do to the people of Hong Kong, to the people of Tibet and the people of East Turkey.
Well, look, Amy and Tom, thanks very much for joining us. And I just hope that you can win. This is always difficult when you're a David versus a Goliath, but wish you the very best of luck. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Okay, so that's a couple of Hong Kongers from Bristol here. The latest we've heard, Martin, is that a new Hong Kong security chief is to be a hardliner called Zheng Zanyong, and he was involved in 2011 when disaffected locals in another part of China forcibly expelled government officials from the area, accusing the officials of stealing land in a series of corrupt deals with developers. Echoes of our own mayor and the Bristol there. A blockade ensued, and as part of a negotiated settlement to diffuse tensions, the locals were given the right to elect their own council, became a grassroots democratic exemption in China. But 5 years later, residents, angry that money has still not been paid for this land, they were on marching on the streets again. And this guy put down this whole uprising. So he seemed to be a very hardline guy who will simply deal with whatever situation he finds, Martin, in Hong Kong, and deal with it in a police, and if the police can't deal with it, in a military fashion.
Well, it's an ongoing conflict, isn't it? And it's not just Hong Kong. As mentioned there, you've got Tibet, Xinjiang, and don't forget the general politics of the situation are daggers drawn between the US and China. Amy there was saying about the arrest of the Huawei executive that she's a criminal, but what she's accused of is trading with Iran. So all of these things are linked, and I'm afraid Hong Kong's aspirations are part of a general conflict that's going on in the world about who's going to rule the roost. And of course, the US has got a whole series of secret prisons all over the world, in which is holding we don't know how many people who are being tortured and so on. And so the Chinese Communist Party, they turn around to the Americans and say, well, you know, you're overthrowing democratic governments in Latin America. That's you claim that's your backyard.
So
well, this
are
is
you
our
saying
backyard.
That China is just as bad as, or the United States is just as bad as China?
Well, I'm just saying that the idea that there's one side that's good and another side that's bad
the thing is, basic freedom of speech is going now in Hong Kong. It may be that there's still going to be a little bit of it.
The thing that crosses my mind about this, in terms of British politics, you've got the senior leading Tories now, like Priti Patel and Rishi Sunak, who were basically Ugandan Asians. And when they were kicked out of Uganda, they all came to Britain. Enoch Powell and others weren't very happy about it at the time.
This is Idi Amin, is it?
This is Idi Amin, chucked them out, yeah. And in actual fact, there's lots and lots of people out there in the former British Empire who are not having a very good time. I could mention, for example, the Palestinians who are living in camps in Jordan and Syria after they were ethnically cleansed in the 1940s.
So do you think Hong Kong is going to end up like that?
I'm just saying, who has the right to come and live in Britain because they're being given a hard time? And of course, the whole question from the Chinese government's point of view, well, they're saying, well, you only got Hong Kong because you took it in two wars that you fought against the Chinese government of the day. And there's no sense in which you can say that this belongs to you.
Can't be said for the people who live there, though, Martin, can it?
No, but at the same time, they live there. I mean, should they be allowed to come to Britain? I'm agnostic about that. If the government decides in the end that 3 million Hong Kong Chinese can come, I'd accept that. The question is whether Nigel Farage would accept that, and would Nigel Farage accept that we could take a couple of million Palestinians who've been living statelessly in refugee camps because we handed over their country to the Israelis. Now, of course, in actual fact, what's actually going to happen is the Hong Kong Chinese are going to be given a privileged status. They're going to be allowed to come, but the idea that we're taking 2 million Palestinians is completely unthinkable. But if you think about the rights and wrongs of it all, if people should be able, I mean, don't forget, we've devastated both Iraq and Libya, and that people who are running away from those wars have every right to come and ask to come and live in Britain, haven't they? Because we're the ones
also in the first place. This week, that China is forcing birth control on Uyghur women to curb the Muslim population. The report finds this is on Sky. Put a link up to it on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. One expert says the evidence uncovered shows the state is engaged in genocide. Now, this is an effective the problems with the China government has with Muslims are part really of a worldwide persecution of the faith.
Well, that's true, but don't forget that the Turkish Secret Service, MIT, has been training and orchestrating what essentially jihadi groups inside Xinjiang. So there's quite a lot of Xinjiang people fighting in Syria against the Syrian government because they've been funneled in there by the Turks. So, of course, they'll ultimately be funneled back into China. And the Chinese army have got people on the ground with the Syrian army watching them fight.
Does this justify the Chinese government forcing birth control on Uyghur women?
No, it doesn't. I'm not saying that for a moment, but I think you've got to see this whole thing. What should be happening is constructive cooperation between the Western powers and Russia and China. And, you know, if we were doing normal business with China, they could perhaps tolerate, you know, much more liberal-minded attitude towards opposition in Hong Kong. But you can see that the mindset of the Chinese government now, where potentially they suspect that there's a biological warfare attack on them in Wuhan, where they're they've got three aircraft carriers in the West Pacific, in the East Pacific now, threatening the Chinese coast. They think that they're being attacked, and because they are being attacked. Now, ultimately, the Western powers have got to decide: do they want to overthrow the Chinese Communist Party? Because if they do, then they'll have to fight with them, and they're going to fight back. And the people in Hong Kong were just going to be roadkill in those circumstances.
Well, we heard quite a lot there about the social credit system in China. A lot of people have been drawing parallels, actually, with the track and trace system over here, saying that it actually is an enormous erosion of our civil liberties in surveillance. Obviously, it's helping with finding potentially people that you might have been close in contact with who've got the COVID-19. But I thought it'd be useful to have a look at the bigger picture here. And I noticed what I thought was a terrific interview with Edwin Black this week. Edwin is the author, the Jewish author, of a book called IBM and the Holocaust, which I've covered several times, the links between IBM and what they were basically doing was hiring these Hollerith machines right the way through the Second World War to the Nazis, this US IBM company, which they were using to catalogue and categorise their citizens, including, you know, putting people into ethnic groups and religious groups, so that, for example, it would be very simple for a newly occupied city for the SS or Gestapo to be given a whole bunch of punch cards from this IBM system to then go out and arrest all the people of a particular religious or ethnic group in that city. But Edwin Black's book, IBM the Holocaust, came out probably 20 years ago or so. But he's taken a great interest in the Chinese social credit system and also the big changes that we're seeing and an erosion of civil liberties due to COVID-19. So I thought it'd be useful to have a listen to that now. He talks here about the algorithm ghetto, which I think it's fair to say we are in. We're certainly on YouTube, Martin. You know, if you search even for the title of one of our shows and for some of the content, you'll find it's maybe two or three or four or five or six pages down, even though that's exactly what you were searching for. It won't be at the top of the search anymore. So that's your YouTube ghetto. But he's also talking about the algorithm ghetto. But he's also talking about implications for a cashless society and what he calls eugenics, a kind of new version of eugenics. So let's have a listen to Edwin Black now.
The Geopolitics and Empire podcast is joined by the award-winning and best-selling investigative author Edwin Black. He has written about the connections between American eugenics, American industry, Nazi Germany, and the Holocaust. Mr. Black believes the eugenics movement has come back to life in a way as a new science he calls eugenics. We have travel restrictions based on health certificates that have been proposed together with this invasive contact tracing apps.
You mean health passports?
Okay. Yes, exactly. And
so that would be an identification of the individual on what his deemed status was as he moved about.
Mm-hmm. And then you can tell us a bit about that. And many of the actors involved now with these systems seem to be some of the same actors involved in the movement, the eugenics movement that worked with the Nazi regime a century ago, as you detail in your book. We've got the Rockefeller Foundation and IBM, and together with their modern counterparts, Google and Microsoft. And I also believe we're beginning to see signs of this beyond China. Americans are having social media accounts terminated. My viral interview with Francis Boyle discussing the possibility of COVID-19 leaking from the Wuhan lab was promptly deleted by YouTube. Some people have even been blacklisted from travel apps such as Uber and Airbnb, even financial platforms. And so you call this the algorithm ghetto. It's quite frightening. Few people are discussing it. And given your insight into our eugenics past, in the short time that we have with you, could you break down for us this eugenics, cashless society, and the algorithm ghetto?
Now, I did write about this. I believe the book you're referring to is my book, War Against the Weak, which is available in 190 countries, including Kazakhstan. Do you have Amazon in Kazakhstan?
Yes, we do.
Okay, it's available in Kazakhstan. So I actually dealt with this on my own show, The Edwin Black Show, in one of the early episodes, how the COVID-19 was leading to a dramatic erosion of our personal liberties. So there's a lot to unpack. First of all, the goal of the eugenics movement in the United States in the first three decades of the 20th century was to create a white, blonde, blue-eyed, Aryan, Nordic individual who would have dominance over all other humans on Earth and indeed would be deemed the only one entitled to live and propagate. The others were to be segregated, terminated, executed, subjugated. That was going to be the master race. This was transmogrified into Nazi Germany that studied our system. The whole idea of what we were doing in the United States in terms of forced surgical sterilization, medical concentration camps called sanitariums, this artificial intelligence testing, the designation of individuals as subhuman, all of this was replicated and amplified in Nazi Germany at a tremendous velocity and ferocity that resulted in the Holocaust and the mass murder and subjugation of millions of Europeans. We are, as I said in my book and many of my lectures, eugenics is confronting the world now. And eugenics will create a master race or an enriched race or an ennobled race based not on racial dogma and national creed, but on corporate worth or corporate value. Or you could substitute in the governmental ruling class worth or government ruling class value. That is being done right now in China with the social credit system, in which tens of thousands, indeed hundreds of thousands of individuals are being constantly rated and re-rated by who they talk to, what they do, what they say, what they think, what they post, based on facial recognition on this massive Skynet system where everyone is under constant observation. I say Skynet not because we're talking about the movie that you wanted to see, Terminator, but that is what it's called. And it works on every street and even in some cases inside many buildings. It links up your face rec to your social media, to all your commercial activity, your political activity. Based on that, you will be allowed to buy a bus ticket. allowed to buy a train ticket, a plane ticket, a better car, or if you consort with, associate with, communicate with someone who has a low ranking who's considered not in good standing with the government, you'll have your own social credit ranking lowered, even if that's your brother or your sister. Think of the credit card system and the credit system we have in the United States. It's all financially based. In the United States, we have credit bureaus, you have credit cards, you can, they don't care what kind of a person you are, as long as you have the green. That's not the case in China, which is a totalitarian, party-controlled society. And now, one of the great dangers that has come to mankind is when this impulse of the Chinese and many others like them, not just in China, there's North Korea, there's part of the United States, which is ranking people, comes into contact and is facilitated by these software programs that can virtually do away with you based on an algorithm. You just said it to us. You said that your YouTube video was taken down. And does that mean that this will be taken down too if we complain about it? Your YouTube video was taken down. You said something else was canceled and taken down. And what this means is the algorithm ghetto will relegate your position from the first row to the fourth balcony in the rear. No one will see you. You may not see anyone else. And so you'll be on the rooftops screaming at the top of your voice and no one will hear you. Your tweets will be zombied. Your Facebook will be zombied. Your YouTubes will be zombied. And you don't need to wait for a knock at the door. In fact, your problem is there probably won't be a knock at the door. No one will be knocking because you will be driven into a non-entity. If you combine this with the cashless society, it means that even for money, you won't be able to buy bread. You won't be able to buy milk without permission of the state. We are now running into a hyper 1984 status, and COVID-19 has dramatically boosted it like several booster rockets. And in a span of 60 to 90 days or 30 to 90 days, the world has transmogrified into facial recognition, into an invasion of personal health privacy. We have a law in the United States called HIPAA. It means they can't disclose any of your health information. All that's going by the wayside. We have people, we have political agendas where not more than 10 people can gather in a church, but 50 people can gather in a marijuana shop. And people cannot honor their loved ones on Memorial Day in a cemetery, but somehow the protest movement is encouraged and enabled. Don't get together and have life as you know it, but it's okay if you're protesting. The inconsistency of these rules, the arbitrariness of it, the fact that you can go to one of our big homeware stores. There's one here in the United States called Home Depot. I don't know if you have them there, but you can buy wood or lumber, but you can't buy a plant. So none of these things make sense, and they're enforced. So while protesters are not arrested, people trying to have a religious service or give a haircut in the United States are arrested for violating these social distancing rules. Now, that comment had nothing to do with the atrocity that happened to George Floyd. But there are two atrocities going on now in the United States. The one that happened to George Floyd, who was tortured and lynched on national television in a slow-moving execution, and the subsequent trigger of enormous violence that has struck the United States. So we're in much greater danger than we were today than at New Year's. We are in much greater danger tomorrow than we were last week. We're in much greater danger next month than we were last month. And the greatest danger of them all will culminate in the first week of November, when we're probably going to see conduct and actions like you would never believe we would have in the United States. RFID will be the final cog in the wheel, because with RFID, radio frequency identification, people will not only be tracked by their phones, not only be tracked by their face rec, they'll be tracked with either an implant under their skin, and many people have such an implant now, or they'll be tracked with the driver's license that's in their wallet. In other words, they'll be tracked even when they stay home, and not only will they be tracked, but their garbage will be tracked. So if all the food in your refrigerator has an RFID tag, and what you throw out in terms of milk, what you throw out in terms of food, your choice of food, your all that stuff will then be thrown into the garbage. There'll be scanners going down the street in the same way that you have scanners going down the street collecting cell phone information and driver's license information. We're not headed to a good time. Why do you ask?
Well, I mean, it's frightening. And just to kind of see the end game, what would it look like? You mentioned the cashless society, the RFID. And if someone's locked out, or if someone, you know, we have someone who's Amish or just rejects this kind of system, I mean, will they literally starve to death? What will it look like for people who don't want to go along with this? And will it be global? Do you see this like going beyond China to, will we experience it in Europe, the U.S., Latin America?
It'll be global. It will be like various fires, like various trash fires or wildfires. It'll burn in one place. It'll spread to another, burn in another place, spread to another. The burn rates will be unequal. I would say the two leading contenders for the reduction in liberties will be China and the United States. And what will be the end game? You don't want to be here for it. You want to know if there's hope, right? And, you know, I'm frequently asked that question. And I say, no. There's no hope. But what there is visual acuity. You can do the best for yourself, for your neighbors, for your family, and for your nation, for the world, by being aware of what you're being asked to do and where you are going. The people in Scandinavia who lined up to get an embedded chip in their hand that would allow them to go into their ordinary office building, it'd be a big convenience. And we've got a store here owned by Amazon. Nobody will use any money. There will be no checkout. They've got grimace control. Do you know what that is? Well, there's a little icon in your phone, and it always shows it's watching your facial expressions. So they've got grimace evaluation, grimace control, gesture control, and you'll be under constant scrutiny as you walk in and out, pick up an apple, return the apple, pick up a can of soup with a red label, put it back, pick up another can of soup with a green label, take that can of soup. It'll all be tied into your account. You'll walk out the door with whatever you have. There won't be any such a thing as shoplifting, but what there will be is biolifting of all your biometrics. And so that's being done right now in the name of progress. So the people who are going into that store and are being guinea pigged, the people in Scandinavia who said, please chip my hand because I just think it's cool, cool, cool. The people who are saying, well, first I put a chip into my dog so I wouldn't lose it. Now I'm going to put chip into my daughter or my Alzheimer grandparents so we can track him. You see, the system is always going to start with the most innocuous and understandable applications. Oh, let's just chip the criminals. We won't have to keep them in a prison. We won't have to give them bond. We'll know where they are at all times. But then this is how it grows. And there may be nothing wrong with chipping the criminals. We already have leg monitors for the criminals. But now they're talking about these types of monitors being applied to regular people so that they will stay 6 feet apart, or they may go or not go where the society wants them. Who's doing this? It's unelected governance. Remember, what is democracy? Democracy is the governed giving consent to the governance. Correct? That was born, the concept of democracy was born in the desert when the Israelites left Egypt. And in Leviticus 25:10, it says, go forth and spread liberty throughout the land. They conjured up the idea of equality. They conjured up the idea of liberty. They conjured up the idea of a judiciary, which had not existed until that time. They conjured up the idea of judges, of a system of equal justice. It's all in Leviticus. This took 3,000 years to maturate and was adopted by the United States into something called the American Revolution. And it created democracy. And there have been two impulses. You know, it's just like the universe. The universe is spreading and contracting. So there's always the notion of widening the circle of entitlement to democratic values and systems. You will remember that America had slavery, that women could not vote, that the landless could not vote. All that has been changed. More people are included. We still have a long way to go. They're not included. Equally, but as we make this progress, as the circle of entitlement expands and more people are enabled, there are other people who want to contract. There are other people who want to dominate. There are other people who basically say our way is better than your way. And that is the lack of choice and approving of those who govern us. Because when we don't approve who governs us, we no longer have democracy. I just hope that people will understand that our past has been tense, our present is currently tense, but we cannot self-determine our future unless we are aware of our past. And for most people, there is so much falsity in the world, so much false narrative. The loudest voice is often the most heard and penetrated voice. People don't have the knowledge to understand where the road is going. You know, in our world today, there's unprecedented information, but very little knowledge.
So that's Edwin Black there, speaking to Kazakhstan Radio. Martin, is so much in there, but he's really painting a pretty bleak picture. He's saying that effectively that the elites are taking more and more control, but that they can really only control us if we don't know what they're up to.
Well, I think they can still control us anyway, even if we do know what they're up to. A lot of what he was saying reminded me of a book I've just read. It's called Homo Deus, A Brief History of Tomorrow. It's by an Israeli academic called Yuval Noah Harari. And basically, it's basically about AI and what's happening. And of course, they're now able to, they're reaching the level of sophistication where they can know what you are going to do before you do. So in other words, they're able to predict human behavior by looking at lots and lots of data sets. And also you may think that you decide to have a cup of tea, but they can see a neural something happening in your brain, literally just before you decide to have the cup of tea. And it's a very interesting book because it takes what he's talking about to another level. Can I just also say, yes, we're under total surveillance. It's very sinister. There's a potentially very negative side to it. But don't forget, we could find ourselves in a world war soon where all of the combatants will be using those techniques in order to make their soldiers fight harder, to kill the enemy and all the rest of it. And being chipped is not the worst thing that can happen to you.
One of those things that I think you mentioned this last week, Martin, is the possible role of 5G in a military conflict. Looking at the Voltaire Network, it was in June this was published, 5G, the new track of the arms race. While Canada has just authorized the extradition of Meng Wanzhou, the daughter of one of Huawei's leaders, to the United States, the U.S. Congressional Research Service exposes the military component of 5G. Red flag, they say the most important air maneuver in the United States took place last March at this Nellis Air Force Base in Nevada with the participation of German, Spanish and Italian forces. The latter were also composed of F-35 fighters, which the Air Force says were integrated with the best of American military aviation in order to exploit the full potential of the aircraft and weapon systems on board, including nuclear ones, by the way. 5G mobile networks consisting of towers that can be assembled and disassembled in less than an hour for rapid transfer, depending on the operation in progress, will be in operation for testing in a real environment. Nellis Air Base is the fifth selected by the Pentagon to test the military use of 5G. The others are in Utah, Georgia, California, and Washington State. A Congressional Research Service paper explains that the fifth generation mobile data technology has many military applications. One such application is for autonomous military vehicles, that is, robotic air, land, and navy vehicles capable of autonomously performing attack missions without even remote control. So this is one of the potential methods or uses of 5G, Martin, is it could militarize our towns and cities. And who's to say whether the United States, Britain, or China is going to be controlling those 5G networks?
Well, that's what this rowing about Huawei's involvement in Western systems is all about. And as I say, the woman that was arrested, Chinese woman, she was supposedly breaking US sanctions on Iran, and which we all know that's totally free and fair, the Americans deciding things like that. And the other thing that occurs to me is EMP. Basically, the Russians and the Chinese have developed what basically knocks out the other side's electronic communications. So the Americans may be developing these very sophisticated AI platforms to make their weapon systems work.
It's one of the interesting things about
this. You just knock out electronics, none of it's going to work.
5G is inherently insecure because it's wide open to the electromagnetic spectrum, whereas, say, something like fiber is much less insecure. It's much, much easier to keep fiber private and to make sure that, say, for example, a foreign power doesn't take it over.
That's right. And I think that if you look at what happened in the Ukraine, the Russians were starting to use some of the and what happened to the USS Donald Cook off the coast of Ukraine. They basically knocked out its electronics. So it's all very well. I mean, these sophisticated electronic systems for tracking everybody or whatever. What if somebody comes along and knocks all those out and they're prepared to fight blind because they haven't got any, they don't use electronics? So, you know, the warfare is actually always going to be unpredictable and unpleasant. I mean, it's not always going to be straightforward.
Another red flag that Tevin Black picks up there is this whole idea of the military taking over all of our health information. This is one of the things that slipped under the radar during the pandemic, is both GCHQ and the NSA getting access to all of our health data because they said that this was a national emergency. Now, this data from the NSA and GCHQ, there's no guarantees that's going to be secure, and no guarantees they're not just going to sell it on to a third party, say maybe the insurance industry or the pharmaceutical industry.
Well, that's right. I mean, Peter Thiel has got access to all sorts of NHS data because he's been let in by Dominic Cummings. But you mean, the way you can defend yourself against people stealing your data is you set up your own data collection and make sure it's secure. But of course, they brought in all of these AI specialists who are private entrepreneurs, and they get access to all of that data. And then, of course, what are they going to do with it? Who knows? You can see that the dystopian future is definitely there to happen. There's an awful lot about it in the book I mentioned earlier. But it's not just about the fact that they're going to be observing everybody. They observe everybody anyway. The question is, what do they want? What are they trying to do? And of course, ultimately, what we're talking about is the West going to war with China and Russia, defeating them and then ruling the roost for hundreds of years if they can get away with it. But at the same time, of course, the people they're up against ain't going to roll over.
Well, of course not. I don't think there's any guarantees at all. In fact, looking at the F-35 fighter, for example, one of the bits of military kit, this thing just doesn't stand up at all, despite its massive $100 million paycheck you're paying for it. What you're getting is basically a pile of junk. Yes. Anyway, also, finally, Marty, I thought we'd round off this week with a look at the June 16th, out it came. It's the Reuters annual trust survey of journalism. COVID-19 apparently has prompted a boom for TV news, but a dip in media trust, which contradicts what you were saying last week about the BBC being congratulated for a very good COVID coverage. A surge, apparently, in misinformation. The 2020 Digital News Report, this is. This has seen a resurgence in people turning to TV, but a diminishing of trust in TV. The most important figures, I suppose, are the trust figures, aren't they? You know, do we trust what we see on the news? I mean, obviously, a lot of people don't bother to watch it anymore. But those that do, 28% only say they trust it. The rest say, no, we don't. Now, that's the biggest fall they've ever seen, which is minus 12% in the UK in a year, Martin.
Well, I mean, these are challenging times for everybody, aren't they? Everybody's having to look at their life, their lifestyle, their friendship networks, to what's happening at a global and a national level. Not surprisingly, the people have got more information than ever, but also they recognise that there's all sorts of lies of disinformation out there. And of course, every week we try and trip our way through the forest. You can see why.
There's been an enormous falling off. I mean, if that minus 12%, much more than that minus 12%, something like 18%, I think it looks like from the graph, is the left. Apparently, the left now feel that the media is talking absolute nonsense. But this isn't. We're not really talking about the Labour Party here. We're talking about left-wing viewers and readers and listeners saying that there is nothing for them really in the British media.
Well, I mean, basically, as a left-winger, I know that the mainstream media in the country is basically dominated by the oligarchy. The BBC is indirectly dominated by the oligarchy, so they make ridiculous drama documentaries like the Skripal nonsense. And then you've got the Tory press who are baying for blood at every turn. Information is power, and most people are deprived of it. unless, of course, they've got the time or the inclination to go into things as deeply as we try to do.
I mean, it does seem to me as if people are being driven around from platform to platform, you know, almost herded around like cattle. I mean, obviously, in the early days of television, there was a need to get everyone to buy TVs, put them in their home. So there was a reasonable, more reasonable than today, anyway, balance in the news and the drama, whatever, that we got on TV. Then that's been taken over, as we were saying earlier, you know, talking about that Dispatches documentary about PC Yvonne Fletcher. That was taken over in the 1990s and slowly driven underground until there's, you know, people like the Roger Cook and the Cook Report destroyed. So that by the year 2000, there was virtually no investigative journalism left. And then, lo and behold, we get the 9/11 attacks. So people being driven, if they really are intelligent and they want to get some discerning news content, they have to go online. And slowly but surely, we've seen the growth also in social media, haven't we, where people are basically sharing stories with their friends. And for example, for many under 30-year-olds now, they just simply don't have TV. They don't watch TV. They get all their news and information on either a smart TV, which doesn't, you know, they don't have to look at the boring old, you know, BBC, ITV, news channels, that sort of thing. And so they're getting a lot of information from social media. But the final thing I wanted to talk about this week, Martin, is this enormous pressure that there's been from companies this week on Facebook saying that unless you get rid of what they call hate speech, on your platform, we're going to pull all of our advertising. Now, there's no need to get too concerned, apparently, according to CNN, because very few of the main advertisers on Facebook are part of this coalition. But there's quite clearly a bunch of big companies, including Unilever, etc., who have got together to say, we want you to accept our definition of what is hate speech on Facebook and remove it, or we're not going to advertise anymore.
Well, if you think about it, it's just an iteration of what's gone on in the past. Advertisers were able to tell people who used to be, you know, paper journalists on things like the New York Times, if you print that article, I mean, if you read Seymour Hersh's autobiography, Reporter, you know, the basically advertisers determine what you read. And that's, we all know that there's basically enormously powerful forces, both corporate and state, which are trying to mould the minds of the population.
Yeah, I seem to remember an article.
It's just going on and on, isn't it?
The Guardian printed an article by Robin Cook, didn't it, about Al-Qaeda. Do you remember that one?
Yes. Well, I don't remember the particular article.
And maybe, I think, possibly around about the same time as they printed one by Michael Meacher too, which was very critical of the war on terror and the 9/11 attacks and the idea of attacking Afghanistan, blah, blah. You know, just chatting to people who worked at The Guardian, they were saying that immediately, as soon as that article appeared, that millions or even tens of millions of pounds, like 6 months or a year's worth of advertising, is pulled from the newspaper as soon as an article like that appears. So you do wonder whether a newspaper is just is actually adverts with a few nice articles next to them that look nice, or articles with nice little adverts next to them that look nice.
Well, yes, and also you've got the intelligence services also pulling strings, as the German journalist Uto, I've forgotten his second name, saying, I just basically wrote CIA copy for years. What can happen, of course, is that people get more and more aware of the nature of the media environment, and they look for alternative sources of information.
Hence this minus 12%,
check what they're told.
Yeah, and hence this minus 12% for trusting TV news. Just to mention the three biggest companies that are trying to tell Facebook to adopt their definition of hate speech. They're Microsoft, Starbucks, and Pfizer. Of course, Microsoft is Bill Gates' firm. But, I mean, at the end of this, Twitter, for example, has pulled... suspended permanently Graham Lyon. And I don't know if you know who he is. He was the writer, creator of the Father Ted series. Yeah. He was suspended because he put a tweet out saying men aren't women. And now that just seems to me unbelievable that he can have his... It's just literally a tweet saying men are not women. And he is suspended and permanently. for saying that in a reply to a transgender pride post. Now, I mean, obviously that may be offensive to somebody, but there's always, whatever anybody says, including, I'm sure, what we say here, someone is going to say, I found that offensive. But how do you define what is and isn't?
Well, the fact of the matter is that Twitter is a private organisation, and just like the Daily Mail, they can say whatever they want to say. And if they don't want you to be on their platform, they can ban you. If it was all of these things were publicly owned and we had public rules about who can say what, as, for example, is the case with Ofcom and terrestrial broadcasting, as we know, then that would be one thing. But, of course, if you're going to have a private sector-run scenario, then basically if I pay the piper, then he plays my tune. And that is the way the media has always worked before the digital age. You had basically governments and corporations paying for lies, and who can stop them? It's called freedom of speech. But if I have freedom of speech, we're not obliged to have anybody on this show if we don't want them, for example. So we're exercising censorship against people we don't want to have on here. But the same thing happens at bigger level.
I mean, I wouldn't agree. I'm quite happy to have almost anybody on, actually.
Well, I know, but that's a personal choice, isn't it? You could easily decide not to.
Including people with whom I profoundly disagree. And I think that's actually what makes for a healthy environment, is when you've got...
Well, I agree with you, Tony, but you can see that, the Daily Mail doesn't give Jeremy Corbyn a fair crack of the whip, does it? And it's not expected to.
No, but for example, social media like Facebook and Twitter, the idea is that everybody is equal. Just give us your thoughts on this, men aren't women. I mean, is that something that you think it's okay to say?
There's clearly a debate going on around this question of trans rights or whatever. Lots of people have got different views about it. And, to my mind, you should basically listen to what everybody's got to say. I mean, I'm pretty much on the same page as you about that. People can say what they like, can't they? But then I'm going to say what I like.
I mean, what I'd say is, just to draw a line under this, really, is that you can say absolutely anything you want, so long as it's not an incitement to a criminal offence. That's the end of the line, as far as free speech goes to me.
Well, I agree with you. But I'm even prepared to have people make what I would regard as fascist statements. But I think it's my right to say you're a fascist as well, with the implication that I'm going to war with you, which is that's speech as well, isn't it?
And I mention this again and again, don't I? William Joyce, right the way through the Second World War from Radio Luxembourg, is broadcasting fascist propaganda. At no point does the British government think we're going to block this. They allow him to broadcast all this propaganda, and then they send it up. Time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. You can download our MP3s and listen in the car or anywhere you like. You'll find this show's podcast, story links, comment page, and our contact details at thisweekoneword.org.uk. I'm on Twitter, I hope still, just about, at Tony Gosling. Here's wishing you a relaxing, enjoyable BCFM weekend. Sunday evenings with Danny Lopsch, as always, a good choice. BCFM's Pat Hart, chief executive, doesn't going to let us back on the air for the time being, but you can email him if you like via our contact page at thisweek.org.uk, and we're hoping to be back in November. At least that's the latest promise. Despite those promises, also, we've had dialect taken off the air too, so we may be back in November. But don't hold your breath, dear listeners. We'll still keep plugging away on here, mind. Do please join us for the Politics Show live stream online at the old time of 5 o'clock, 2 hours or 2.5 hours next Friday. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.